And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. So much to get to, so much to talk about. The circus going on in D.C., the Conservative Political Action Conference, or just call it Crazy Circus. Just call it a bunch of insanity under one big tent of people slapping each other on the back. You're so right. Oh, you're so honest. You're so good. Oh, you're such a hard worker. Those lazy, slothy people, they just want handouts. Wow. Anyway, tonight on the program, we're going to talk with former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel, going to be here talking about what's going on in the Ukraine, what's going on with whistleblowers, what's going on with the secrecy of the most transparent administration in the history of the civilization. We're also going to talk with Michael Sherrard from Faithful America about this religious extremism. At some point, the good, honest, decent people who call themselves Christians and who actually are decent people, they've got to push back against the insanity that has gripped the right wing of our country. We'll talk about that. Also in the second hour, John Jackson, a pork truck driver from Savannah, Georgia, going to be on the program talking about the push by the Teamsters down there to, one, get these workers properly classified, to get them classified as employees, because they are. When you're driving the company truck, you're following the company rules, you're wearing the company uniform, and you're doing what you're told at the directive of the said company, one can only come to a rational, sane conclusion that you are indeed an employee, not your own boss, not somebody who come on, I'm going to do my own business. You're at their will. And we'll talk about the organizing campaign that's going on down there. And also, Isaiah Poole from the Campaign for America's Future will be here. It is our Future Friday. We'll talk about the job numbers that have come out. 175,000 new jobs. Some say good, some say bad. Right about demographics. As growth, we're not falling behind. That's a good thing. I'd like to see more. I'd like to actually see some investment. I'd like to see us, do a little bit better, get more people back to work. So 175,000 jobs, new ones, unemployment ticked up, I guess, 0.1, a little jump. But I guess that's good. More people are looking for work. That's a good thing. Maybe we'll then have more people complaining and saying, hey, do something. Also, I think your calls, your thoughts, your questions, your comments, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Well, I got to start off right with the Paul Ryan thing. I got it a little bit yesterday, and I got some emails from folks who said, no, Paul Ryan didn't actually say all those really horrible, stupid things, did he? And I said, yeah, I mean, the reality is Paul Ryan is a political hack. I mean, it's all about the narrative. You know, we talked about his budget ideas. We talked about his report on reforming our social safety net programs. You know, those welfare people are just getting free stuff. Cherry-picked to death. And I guess, when you start at the end, when you go, this is my conclusion, and now I've got to find the data to make that true. Exactly what he did. If we had a functional media structure in this country, no one would listen to this guy again. It would be reported far and wide that he's full of you-know-what. That what he put out was nothing more than propaganda coming from our government. And a fringe portion of the government to destroy the government. I mean, that's the part that gets me. So he was at the circus yesterday, and given his little speech, and I just got to play it because I think it's one of those things that you just go, did he really say that? And the answer is, yeah. He starts off by saying he's got some advice for the left.
The left is making a big mistake here. What they're offering people is a full stomach and an empty soul.
Ah.
The American people want more than that.
Ah, yes, they do. They want jobs.
You know, this reminds me of a story I heard from Eloise Anderson. She serves in the cabinet of my buddy, Governor Scott Walker.
Ah, your buddy. Oh, there you go. Your buddy. Mary Wright up there.
She once met a young boy from a very poor family.
Did she now?
And every day at school, he would get a free lunch from a government program.
Ah.
He told Eloise he didn't want a free lunch. He wanted his own lunch, one in a brown paper bag, just like the other kids. He wanted one, he said, because he knew a kid with a brown paper bag had someone who cared for him. This is what the left does not understand.
Anybody want to jump in on that? Anybody want to just, you know, wow. Wow, that's it's a huge statement. Can you imagine, you know, an 11-year-old saying that? Maybe, but he didn't. And you go back and good on the Washington Post. They went and looked at it and said, this is something worth investigating. Yes, we've got to find out if this is actually true. And, you know, it's very much in line with a book titled An Invisible Thread, a story that was thrown into that from, you know, someone in New York in 1986. I don't know how Eloise, you know, could have got to that, but, you know, an aide to a Wisconsin governor. But, hey, you know, hey, what I like about these anecdotal situations is, now, he's not saying it was anecdotal. He's saying she knew somebody. And she told him, and so one or two people are full of you-know-what. Somebody's full of something. But to get to the heart of this statement, which is on so many levels vile, on so many levels disgusting, on so many levels just... to sit here and think of which words exactly I want to use without being thrown off the air by the FCC, because when I first heard this, my first response was I wanted to reach out and strangle somebody. Him. How dare he? How dare he, someone who benefited from one of those government handout programs? And I would never in a million years would I ever tell him he wasn't worthy of getting those. And I guess I would ask, does he think, because when his father passed away and he got Social Security disability insurance, or Social Security survivor benefit insurance, that somehow his mother loved him any less? You know, I think back to my time, and I talked to a couple of people today who were kind of in the same world that I was. I hadn't heard that he had said this, and that's the good thing, I guess, about our media. It's only people who are hyper-tuned in, like me, who notice these idiotic circuses in D.C. where they pull these puppets in to rile up the faithful. And I said, you know, this is what the guy said. No, they didn't say that, which is why I had to play the clip. You know, it's bad enough. It's bad enough that, you know, you had to go through the indignity of going in the special line or being checked off the special list so that everyone saw. It's bad enough you have to go through that, but to have this kind of indignity that, well, you know, because your mother and father didn't have the money to pay for your school lunch, that means they don't love you. Because they can't find a job, that means they don't love you. Really? What kind of a check? Or am I just, have I taken this the wrong way? Have I taken it the wrong way in thinking that this was anything more than just political pandering? This was anything more than just, well, you know, we've got this room full of really entitled, very wealthy, very white, very old constituents. Yeah, you know. We've got to pander to them. We want them to think that this is still their America. We're back in the 50s again, and everything's just, we can look down on those people. Now, here's the thing that gets me. And it's one of those things that just, on such a fundamental level, someone like Paul Ryan to be the first one to say that this is a Christian nation. And yet he has the audacity, the unmitigated gall, to say that we're going to have people's stomachs full and their souls empty. Again, nice little bumper sticker, but really just an ugly line. So my question then back to the guy who could have been our vice president. Think about that for a second. Think about for a second the political party that would put someone who would say that a heartbeat away from the most powerful position in the world. You know, I sit and I think about this, and it's infuriating that a guy like this gets a huge platform. Understand, I know very few people who are thrilled. In fact, I don't know anybody who's thrilled that they need food stamps. I know people who are grateful. I know people who are struggling. And I remember being a kid going, you know, this is unfortunate, but at the end of the day, you have to eat. And the assault, the all-out assault on the less fortunate in this country is just sad. And what it is it's that mob mentality. It's that gang mentality. It's that thug mentality that they see somebody weaker. They see somebody that isn't going to be able to put up a fuss, isn't going to be able to fight back, doesn't have the resources, doesn't have the ability, doesn't have the voice to stand up and put a little weasel like this in his place. You know, when I was a kid, he was the LMV. I'll bet you he was the lunch money victim. I'll bet you he's the kid who got beat up every day. And that's why he's such a cruel, nasty. Or am I reading this the wrong way? This idea that, and for me, I guess I'm just hung up with this misuse, this absolute lie. To meet the end, to get to the end result that they want, to get to the conclusion, to get to the punchline, even if everything before it is BS, we got our punchline, we got our talking point. If mom doesn't make lunch, she doesn't love the kids. She's like the woman who drove the three kids into the ocean with the minivan the other day. She doesn't love them. She doesn't want them. If she did, she would go out and beg, barter, steal. She would go out and what? Explain to me this, because here again, these are the people who came into power saying it's all about jobs. Jobs, 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 jobs. Well, what are we seeing them doing? Everything they can do to not create jobs. Everything they can do to hold this country and this economy hostage. Why? Because they don't like the black guy in the White House. Absolutely ridiculous and sickening on so many levels. And I hope you're outraged too. I hope this is something that you, because I know a lot of Republicans. I've had some conversations with the good, decent Republicans that I know who are, you know, they look at this stuff and go, you know, you've got your fringe. But Paul Ryan isn't the fringe. That guy could have been vice president. That's what gets me. And that's what scares me. That's what should scare every one of us. Oh, man. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a settlement with New York's Attorney General, owners of Lage Car Washes in New York City will pay $3.9 million for unpaid wages and underreporting of employees on state unemployment and workers' compensation forms. The Retail Worker Union, RWDSU, and Community Allies are waging an anti-wage theft campaign that highlighted these abuses. The car wash chains will pay $2.2 million to 1,000 workers for nearly 6 years of unpaid wages owed them. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says that when workers like these stand up for their rights, they need to know that state and city leaders will stand behind them.
Unions exist to encourage economic growth and try to spread some of that prosperity to the workers who are out there producing the productivity that drives the economic engine. No one ever has the argument in the right-wing media sphere about the interests of the actual workers themselves. If you are part of a union, you're going to have higher wages than national average wage. Generally, being part of a union is a good thing if you're a worker.
Media Matters economic researcher Craig Harrington. Corporate and conservative media myths about unions create an incessant drumbeat of misinformation and lies about the labor movement that often lead to anti-union policies. Media Matters wants to set the record straight on some of those myths. Harrington says among the myths are that unions caused the auto industry's problems in Detroit, that unions reduce competitiveness, and that good union wages and benefits are driving auto and other companies to send jobs to other countries.
There's a claim that the United Auto Workers Union and unions in general were behind the collapse of the Detroit auto industry, which is blatantly false. But it's something that was an important talking point in right-wing media circles, particularly as the UAW ramped up its attempts to push for a unionization vote in Tennessee. Detroit was caused by decades of mismanagement, the forces of globalization, and general economic decline around the country in the early 2000s, and it really hit Detroit and hit Michigan hard.
Media Matters says the facts are that unions deliver positive benefits for the broader economy, they're vital to reduce inequality, and they increase productivity. New Hampshire's Republican-controlled state Senate has voted to accept federal money to expand Medicaid coverage. About 50,000 people in New Hampshire would benefit from the health protection program passed by an 18-5 margin in New Hampshire's Senate. Democrats control the state House, and the governor supports the bill. A New England College poll shows 66% of New Hampshire residents support the legislation. Tea Party Republicans, though, were and are against it. But the Republican-controlled Senate vote was consistent with widespread majority support from New Hampshire hospitals, doctors, nurses, working families, and business owners for taking that federal money to expand Medicaid. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith. Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Oh, now the good old union's coming here to thrill. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
You know, that starts to be the question. Really, honestly, truthfully, I mean, this is one of those issues. I mean, where politics really should not. Politics should not play anything into this. This is a right or wrong issue. This is a right or left issue. This is one of those things where you go, wait a second, maybe we shouldn't be, maybe this is not something that we should be fighting over. Feeding children, really? Are you kidding me?
But you know, Rick, if we just feed those kids, then, you know, they'll be dependent on that food and they'll want more.
Think about that for a second. Really, I mean, stop and think about the mentality that goes into a statement like that. And we've seen stories across the country where, you know, the kids didn't have 15 cents on their account. And the school lunch the woman at the, you know, the bean counter standing there at the gate takes the lunch and throws it away and says, no, you'll get a milk carton and an apple. That's what you'll get. Nothing for you. I mean, we've seen these stories time and time again. And, you know, I still like what they did in Boston. They said, you know what? We don't care about your ability to pay. We understand that children with full stomachs who aren't hungry learn better. Who would have thunk it? Who would have possibly ever thunk it? That if you're not hungry and you're not, I'm hungry, you might actually want to think about something else. So I'm curious. I would love to hear people's thoughts on this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Do we, as a school district, do we as a state, do we as a nation, is this something that the schools should be doing? Is this something you want in your kid's school? I know where my son goes to school, they're toying with this idea of school breakfast, which I'm all in favor of. Having access right there, I think, is a great idea, especially for those kids who don't get something at home in the mornings. And it's not because their parents don't love them, as Paul Ryan would have us believe. Could be a number of factors. One being, they don't have the money. Remember, we're still kind of in the middle of what would the Bush collapse. We've still got millions of people unemployed and underemployed. Wages have actually gone backwards over the last 5 years. I mean, when you really stop and you think about this stuff, you kind of got to ask the question, you know, what are our priorities? Aren't there other things that we should be focusing on? And I've had these kind of conversations often where people say, well, you know, those poor people just get dependent. I shocked a guy the other day. And it was one of those things where, you know, I don't think he was ready for me to say I didn't care.
He goes, well, you've got all these people cheating the welfare system.
I go, I got to be honest, I really don't care about them right now. I don't care about them cheating the system a little bit, because what they're getting are pennies. They're getting virtually nothing. And when they get caught, and they do, the penalties are draconian. But yet you look at the real welfare queens. You look at the welfare queens and kings and bishops and knights. You look at the wealth class, the aristocracy. You look at the welfare aristocracy that we have in this country. Those people who work on Wall Street, those people who sit in the corner offices, those people who have the big titles on Wall Street and at corporate America, those are the real welfare queens. Corporate welfare far outshadows what we spend in social welfare, by far. Yet, we don't focus on that. You don't hear Paul Ryan talk much about that, do you? And in his defense, and you have to give him a little defense, you can't run for Congress without corporate masters. You can't run for Congress without people who, I still think they should have a NASCAR jacket. You know, who owns them? Honestly. Because it's not you and me. Someone who was really attentive to people like you and me, really attentive to we the people, would never in a million years have said that. Even in a place where he didn't think it would be reported. Even in a place where he thought, oh, we're amongst friends, and maybe this isn't even far enough. How much further can we? I mean, think about this. In my lifetime, and I'm only 46, so in my lifetime, we went from a time period where not only did we give kids school lunch who needed it, we got school lunch during the summertime, where kids would line up at the local public school and be able to have a hot lunch during the summer. And, you know, those kids that I saw in those lines, it was the only hot meal they got most of the time. And you go, well, it's because their parents didn't love them, right? No. It's because they didn't have anything. You know, it's easy to point fingers. It's easy to pull this kind of shenanigans that Paul Ryan would do. When you're not the one struggling, when you're not the one under the weight of poverty. So I'm curious, should we be expanding, or should we be a punitive punishment state? Should we be a state that says, you know what, tough luck, buddy, you're going to learn the lessons, life is tough, short and brutish. Another funny story I saw come out of the CPAC circus today. They have a bunch of these vendors who, you know, they have their little gig, and they're the ones who are, you know, pretty much funding the conference because they're, you know, getting the faithful to buy their stuff and sign up for their think tanks and do all that stuff. There was one guy who worked for former North Carolina Congressman Robin Hayes, currently working with former Congressman J.C. Watts on Insight, which is a minority empowerment program based on the principles of smart government, free enterprise, and personal freedom. Yeah. He says at the CPAC conference, as the executive director of the Center for American Racial Equality or CARE, that it's all about personal freedom, economic opportunity, and free markets. So the free market part is, if you look at the school lunch program, you shouldn't take it because mom doesn't love you if you have to, and if you can't afford the food, you just die. Now, they have an interesting little spin. And what caught my attention about this particular guy, Dwayne Carson, is that he's pimping the idea of the payday loans. Now, remember we talked about this the other day. The payday lenders want into Pennsylvania, and they've got a couple of Republicans who are willing to do their bidding to try and get payday lending here in the Pennsylvania, which I tell you is a horrible idea. We've already talked about the bad stuff. Imagine an interest rate of 300 to 400% on these short-term loans. What I found interesting about Mr. Carson, and you got to give him credit for being honest. His statement was, that he had actually taken out a bunch of payday loans. And, he would take them out $100 at a time or whatever, and in a week he would pay back $115. And he said, is that a bad deal? If you give me a week or 2 weeks with $100, I give you $15. Is that a bad deal? And you go, you're only talking about $15 there. You're talking about 15%. What happens if you can't pay it? And this is where all of this comes into play. Once they got you hooked, the fees, the fines, all of this stuff keep piling up, keep piling up. And then what you end up doing is you write them a check or against your checking account. So they keep trying to cash the check, which means the bank gets to churn a bunch of fees. And at the end of the day, what you end up with is you end up getting really screwed on this. But the conservatives say, this is a way for you to get short-term mini micro loans. Like, you're going to take $100 out and go start a business with $100. Maybe you will. Maybe you're going to be the next Bill Gates. Maybe that $100 helps you buy that first junk computer that you figure out how to whittle with. And maybe that's possible. For one person. For the vast majority, what you end up with is a situation where people are getting ripped off. When I was a kid, the loan sharks, they were always driving the nicest cars. Why? Because they strong-armed a lot of money out of you. And, I start asking the question, what happens if we legalize loan sharking? Because that's basically what this is. If we legalize loan sharking, how do the loan sharks, how do they twist your arm? Do they break? Do we have sanctioned arm breakings? Or do we just start locking people up in debtor's prison? The freedom part, the free enterprise part, the free market part. It just kind of makes you wonder. Now, look, I'm against this idea of absolute communism or socialism or government control of everything. I'm against it. But this idea of laissez-faire free markets that we've never had, understand that never in our history have we had what these people are advocating for, and nor will we, nor do they even want it. It's interesting that the people who talk about how much they want free markets and how much they want freedom and personal responsibility are the ones who are fighting vehemently against any regulation that would say, we got to level the field so that there is true competition, so that the free market can work. And, the free market argument for school lunches, again, I go back to the very simple belief that free markets only work when people have freedom of choice and the freedom to abstain. Choosing between bad idea and worse idea is not freedom. You get that? Anyway. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
to the Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about the case of Nixon versus Hedden, which forced our Supreme Court to decide whether a tomato was a fruit or vegetable. Justice Horace Gray ruled that all that mattered was the category of a tomato that was likely in the minds of the congressman who passed the Tariff Act. They would have thought the common belief, a tomato is a vegetable. The lower court was right. Nix had to pay. So does history matter? Well, it mattered to the New Jersey legislature in 2003 when a representative proposed that the Jersey tomato be designated as the state fruit. That initiative failed. But 2 years later, tomato fans promoted the Jersey tomato again, this time as the state vegetable. Supporters of Assembly Bill 3766 cited Judge Gray's opinion in the 1893 case to support the idea that the tomato and the bill passed into law. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Okay, climate change deniers, you've gone too far. You've gone from just being annoying know-nothings to now posing a serious threat to an essential good that embodies humankind's finest collaboration with nature, beer. It's one thing for the science denial cult to stand in the way of doing something about melting ice caps in the Arctic, but it's another thing altogether for them to mess with beer. This makes it personal. While the deniers keep doing their denial dance, California is drying up. The higher temperatures caused by climate change has produced an ongoing drought that has, among other bad things, caused a precipitous drop in the water level of Lake Mendocino, which could come close to being a dry lake bed this summer. What has that got to do with beer? Glad you asked. Mendocino feeds the Russian River, which flows by the town of Petaluma, home of Lagunitas Brewing Company, which makes very fine beers. A key ingredient in the Lagunitas brew is the excellent water the company draws from the Russian River, which presently is in danger of becoming a trickle. Can't Lagunitas and other breweries along the river just switch to groundwater? No. The head beermaster at Lagunitas notes that heavy minerals in that water would cause it to fizz in the brewing process. Plus, there are concentrations of nitrates, iron, and manganese in the area's groundwater, creating issues of odor, taste, and other unpleasantries that do not add up to good beer. This is Jim Hightower saying, what the Lagunitas experience is teaching us once again is that the nature of nature is that all things are linked together, despite the fantasies of industry shills who insist that their contaminants have no dire consequences. Mess with the global climate, and you mess with Lake Mendocino, which messes with the Russian River, which messes with the beer. And now, you're messing with me and millions of other beer drinkers. Like I said, it's personal.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Yeah, I do, actually. And they seem to walk around with elephants on their shirts. They are, look, this thing with Paul Ryan just has me absolutely infuriated. And Arnold sent me a message during the break that I think is spot on. You know, he goes, nailed it. Ryan was absolutely wrong. Total pig. People of this country should be outraged. And look, you know, I don't care if this was a Democrat who said something stupid like this. I don't care if this was a flaming liberal. I don't care if this was Bernie Sanders. He would never, ever. But I don't care if it was. I would still be enraged. It's just, you know, I guess we've gotten to a point to where our politics in this country are more about my side's got the better zinger, my side wins, it's the chess match, it's the game. I made the other guy look bad. You know, I don't care what the other guy looks like. you know, as a working person, I care that people like me. And this is, you know, I've had some people say, well, it's hard to believe that that's your position. My positions are simple. I think everyone should have the same opportunity that I've had. Starting out in a housing project that needed help from our government, needed help from we the people, needed food stamps, needed housing assistance, needed public education. I now live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers, and I pay my share. I pay a good share of taxes. You think of it, though, in this vein. It's an investment. You think about that, the amount of money, the upfront investment to make sure that, one, I got food, one, there was a shelter, I got an education, I had opportunity. And then over the span of my working lifetime, which will probably be 50 years plus, I will continue to pay that back. See, we don't think that way anymore. And the people who keep telling us that they're business friendly, that they know how to run government like a business, would understand that if you invest in kids early, especially at the really early ages, get them into early education programs, get them into school, after school programs, keep them in, oh, dare shall I say, summer programs, get them year-round academic stimulus, get them year-round experiential learning. It's an investment in tomorrow. It's just, it's so clear to me. And it's so right. And that's what drives me nuts about the political right in this country, is that they are so dead wrong. They shouldn't even be allowed to have the name the right. Because there's nothing right about what they propose. Anyway, today back in 1932, 3,000 unemployed auto workers stood out in the bitter cold in Dearborn, Michigan, demanding jobs and relief from the town owner, Henry Ford. The marchers evidently got too close to the gate. And much like what they did back in those days, you get too close to the gate, we're going to gas you. So they did. They gassed them. And when the workers kind of pulled back, they gathered themselves together, out came the hoses of water, spraying them down in the bitter cold, and then a hail of gunfire. 4 men died immediately. 60 more were wounded. This is how we used to deal with labor strife. This was before you had the National Labor Relations Act. This was before you actually had a place to go and hash out your problems. Now the Republicans, the cons, they want to take us back to those days. Because you know what? They were the ones, and if you've ever seen the movie Hoffa, there is an amazing clip of it. Now, accuracy-wise, there's a lot in there I'm not sure about. And having talked with President Hoffa in the past about it, there's a lot, awful lot of historical inaccuracies. But even beyond that, there's a scene. And it's an amazing scene. You've got hundreds, if not thousands, of these workers who are on strike. And they're in this little courtyard area, and Hoffa's walking through the crowd being questioned by reporters. And up on the, like the fifth or sixth floor, up looking down on all the little worker bees, are the corporate titans, the police chief, the city executives, the city officials, the power structure up in this window looking down on the peasants. And then all of a sudden the side doors fly open where all the trucks and the garage doors used to be. So they have these slow, and thousands of people with clubs and sticks came out and just pummeled these workers. And they're pummeling each other. And the classic moment is where the CEO just pulls the shades closed, turns his back, and walks away. Kind of like, look what we did. Not a concern in the world, because they're disposable. And I keep talking about this idea that we should have some class consciousness, the idea of solidarity, the idea that we are all in this together, and an injury to one is truly, honestly, absolutely an injury to all. If I let that kid whose mother or father can't afford to put a sandwich and an apple in a brown paper bag so that kid can take to school, it is incumbent, it is an absolute mandate that I make sure that kid get fed. because, not just because it's right, because it's good for society. Because at the end of the day, and, you know, we used to learn this. You know, I'm helping coach my daughter's basketball team, of which I am just glowing proud of my 11-year-old daughter. She is, you know, and to take a moment of just kind of a proud father moment, which I rarely do on the program, growing by leaps and bounds, growing exponentially with her self-confidence and her self-esteem, earned self-esteem, not something that we said, oh, you're so smart, oh, you're so good. She's feeling it, and you can see her growing as a person. And the reason I bring this up, because I think it's really vitally important that these processes are in place, these opportunities are in place, these chances all along the life cycle to grow and expand and to gain confidence and self-esteem and self-worth and all of those things, is because she's the next generation. They're the ones who are going to move this country forward or not. These are going to be the people who are the surgeons and the caregivers when I get old. These are the people who are going to carry the mantle of our democracy, of our nation, of this nation forward. And what are we doing to them? We're sitting them in classes with 100 people, 100 kids in a class. We're cutting opportunities. We're gutting programs. And we're the sports program that she's in because she's playing basketball. School doesn't do it because the school cut that years ago. So what are we doing to the next generation? I mean, I look at this and while on one vein, I'm fortunate because we can afford to pay the $150 for her to play on this team. How many people can? And, you know, and I know the league, the team has, you know, would, I'm sure if someone came and couldn't pay it, honestly, I'm sure they would figure out something. But how many families are going to be put in that position and say, oh, okay, yeah, let's go. We'll ask for something. None. Because it's exactly what the opposite of what Paul Ryan was talking about. These people have pride, and people like Paul Ryan want to take that away. These people have dignity, and Paul Ryan wants to destroy that. Why? I have no idea, other than a bloated self-image, a bizarre ideology, but or just to make himself feel superior over others. I don't know. I can't speak for what he knows or what he does, but you know what? These people that I know, these folks who are struggling, they've got pride. And you know what? If they could put something in that brown paper bag, they would. And more, because you know who the most charitable people in this country are? The poor people. It's just that they don't have the resources that someone like the Koch brothers, who funds someone like Paul Ryan. They don't have those kind of resources. I wish they did. I got to be honest. I wish they did. And I guess it takes me back to that biblical story of the little old lady who came to church with a penny. Because it was something. Or her last penny. So many skewed, mixed up, bizarre priorities. And it comes down to us, you and me, to set people like Paul Ryan right. Because here's reality, like it or not, and I think the Great Recession showed a lot of us, that at any minute that could be any one of us. At any minute a catastrophe could happen, we could lose that job, we could lose our health, at any minute, and those could be our children. And how dare somebody have the audacity, how dare they have the gall, how dare they say that if for some reason I don't have the resources to be able to pay for something, to do something, that I don't love my kids? I'm going to leave you with that. Think about that during the break. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Get up and take your money. All they want to do is get up and take your money.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking of you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
This is the Media Matters Minute. Despite ongoing investigations by the FBI and the New Jersey legislature into Governor Chris Christie's involvement with the Washington Bridge scandal, Fox News is already helping Christie rehabilitate his political career. On Fox's America's Newsroom, co-host Martha McCallum painted a sunny picture of Christie's reception at CPAC, saying,
"Now, you know, America loves a comeback kid, so is Chris Christie that comeback kid right now?"
McCallum went on to ponder Christie's 2016 presidential prospects.
And then you have Chris Christie, who says, "Look, you know what? We have to win elections," and he is seen as somebody who may have an easier time of it on a national stage.
Fox has gone to extraordinary lengths to shield Christie, who is widely presumed to be running for president in 2016, from the scandal's fallout. The day the Bridgegate scandal broke, CNN and MSNBC each gave the story more than 2 hours of coverage, but Fox News buried the Christie scandal with barely 15 minutes of coverage. Fox's history of cozy relationships with Republican presidential contenders is well documented, and it appears they intend to keep it that way. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425. Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares.
I would hug a Republican today, absolutely. If it meant that they got a conscience, if it meant that I wouldn't have to listen to idiotic statements like the one that came out of Paul Ryan's mouth, if it meant that the assault on the least among us would stop, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'd even let him say, "Hey, oh, he's gay." I could care less. If it meant them to do the right thing. And you know what? I may even be willing. This is a jump for me. I may be willing to say, you know what? If you'll become decent human beings, if you'll be decent citizens, if you won't go after those who are unable to defend themselves, I may even let you put up those 10 rules you like everywhere. You can put the 10 commandments, plaster them everywhere. If you need that, and this is where my position's always been on this. If you need to have the Ten Commandments everywhere to make you a better human being, maybe it's not a bad idea. Because I find that the people who want it plastered, want them plastered everywhere, are the ones who aren't bright enough to remember them. You know, I went through years of beating in Catholic schools. I got my share of beatings. Yes, there were very angry, repressed nuns. Who hated me and just about every other boy. But they drilled those into me. And, you know them. They're part of who you are. They're not just something that, I saw it on the wall. Oh, yeah, I got to honor my father and mother. Oh, yeah, duh, thanks for that being there. I shouldn't kill anyone. Oh, let's not do that. I shouldn't covet. I shouldn't covet the wife or the goods. Oh, geez, that coveting's odd. See, the coveting's the tough one. And I got to be honest, I got to think that the business community really doesn't want the Ten Commandments plastered everywhere. Because coveting really keeps the economy going. What do you think advertising is? If really, honestly and truthfully, I think we sin absolutely every time. I always said, when I did the weekend show, my line on this was I sin every day twice. Because there was a woman in the neighborhood, a married woman in the neighborhood, and I was honest with my wife, so I don't know if this is a sin or not. I would have to check the official rule book on this. Maybe St. Peter will have this when I get to the gates. But there was a woman, extraordinarily attractive woman, in every way, shape, and form possible, who drove my favorite car, an old Jaguar. Now, I don't want one, but I like, you know, the old 80s version of the very elegant black Jaguar. And every day, you know, I coveted the neighbor's wife and the neighbor's wife's car. Now, not that I would act on those, but that the action isn't, I don't think, necessarily it. You thought of it. That's enough, right? You know what? Maybe if the Ten Commandments were plastered on the front door of my house, maybe I wouldn't have thought like that. So maybe there's something to this. Maybe a 20-ton monument will help us not take food out of the mouths of children. Maybe a massive 20-ton monument will help us to not steal from the poor and give to these huge corporate. Maybe. You know, maybe I'm wrong, though. See, maybe my take on it, maybe it would help. What do you think? Do you think it would help? Do you think plastering them everywhere? I remember when I had the good Pastor James David Manning on, who was famous for Obama's the Mac Daddy. And I asked him, I said, you want the Ten Commandments everywhere, right? Oh, absolutely. I go, well, can you tell me what they are? I got the good book right here. I'll be happy to read it to you. I go, no. I don't want it verbatim. I don't need that. I can do that myself. Just tell me your interpretations of them. Tell me. There are like 10 of them. You should remember all of that, right? Not hard. Couldn't do it. I don't know if he couldn't do it or if he just wouldn't. If it was one of those things where I'm not going to let him be right, so I'll look wrong. Just insane to me. Anyway, it looks like, and this is one of those things, I love it. You gotta love it when these right-wing flack groups, these corporate flack groups, dream up these salacious headlines, these enraging headlines. The headline read, PLCB softened Soviet price controls. They're talking about the wine industry in the state of Pennsylvania, that they're modernizing some of the things. It's a constant movement forward. Because this group, a flat group who won't tell us who their funding comes from, because we know where it comes from. It comes from the billionaire class. It comes from the corporate class who are trying to steal our assets. They're out there pimping this idea that we need to privatize the wine and spirit shop, privatize liquor, give up that asset. And they go into this whole long, you know, blah, 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 blah. But at the end of it, because you know what their goal is. Their goal is to privatize, to get this asset of ours, of yours and mine, this asset that puts hundreds of millions of dollars into our coffers. They want that. Because if there's hundreds of millions of dollars to be had, that's profit. That's money they can put in their pocket. But at the end of it, what caught my attention, and this is one of those things that I find hysterical, because you've got these forces in this state who want to privatize the state-owned, state-run wine and spirit shops, which I think run terrifically well. They control the flow of alcohol, I think, in a very solid way. Because look, if I want a bottle of something, I know where to get it. I want wine. I want Jack Daniels. I want Tanqueray, which was my thing for years. I know where to get it. There's a store. It's just down the road. In fact, there are a couple of them right here. Just right there. I know where they are. I go. I buy my stuff, and bang. I have it. I'm an adult. I know where it is. It's not an impulse buy. I didn't drive through the drive-thru and pick. Oh, you know, I feel like getting all liquored up today. What I find interesting at the end of the article. Because understand that, you know, the forces want to privatize the wine and spirit shops, but they don't want to do anything with the beer distributors. Because the beer distributors already have a monopoly, but you know what? It's a private monopoly. Profiteers, you know, people in the community own the beer distributors. And look, I got nothing against them owning the beer distributors. If I want beer, I know where to get it. But the reality and the polling, all of the polling shows what the people of Pennsylvania really want. They want deregulated beer. They want to be able to go to the grocery store and buy a six-pack. They want to be able to go to the local 7-Eleven or Sheetz or Wawa or What or Hoo-Hoo or whatever and pick up a six-pack or buy a 40 or whatever. And that's not what the Republicans are pimping. because there's no profit in that for them. That's just destroying a profitable system for people who already fund them. That's not in their interest. So I found it interesting that at the end of this screed about privatizing the wine and spirit shops, they're advertising that in Southeast Pennsylvania they're having these beer summits where you can come out and mingle with your fellow free marketeers. I don't know that they got the memo. None of the beer distributors that I know, none of the people that I've met who own these things, want the state to get out of it. They like the monopoly they've got because it's got guaranteed business. The bars like it because if you want to buy a six pack in this state, you got to go to a bar or somewhere that has one of these licenses and pay more than you would otherwise there. They're thrilled. Guaranteed business. Now, understand, at the end of all of this, the goal, and this is all being pushed by the big money interests, this idea, this fantasy, this bizarre fantasy that mom and pop is going to start up a corner liquor store, ain't happening. This idea that mom and pop is going to be able to afford one of these licenses, it just ain't happening. Liquor will become just another impulse item on the shelves. It's going to be right next to the Tic Tacs as you check out. It's going to be on the supermarket aisle. And those 3,000, those thousands of people who have jobs right now, they're done immediately. And there are no more jobs because it just becomes another item on the shelf. Do you really think Walmart's going to hire a wine connoisseur to tell you which wine goes with the store brand mac and cheese? Of course not. Again, I go back to this. Nothing that we have privatized, nothing that has been in the hands of we the people, that we've put into the hands of the profiteers, none of it has been for our good. I've yet to find anyone, and I'm still waiting. If you can think of something that maybe I missed, maybe there was something that we privatized that is running much better, much cheaper, does quality work, and just a wonderful thing. Maybe I missed it. But it's been 9 years now. And I've yet to find it. So maybe you can help me. Anyway, gonna take a quick break. Right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children. Even after they're born. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a settlement with New York's Attorney General, owners of Lage Car Washes in New York City will pay $3.9 million for unpaid wages and underreporting of employees on state unemployment and workers' compensation forms. The Retail Worker Union, RWDSU, and Community Allies are waging an anti-wage theft campaign that highlighted these abuses. The car wash chains will pay $2.2 million to 1,000 workers for nearly 6 years of unpaid wages owed them. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says that when workers like these stand up for their rights, they need to know that state and city leaders will stand behind them.
Unions exist to encourage economic growth and try to spread some of that prosperity to the workers who are out there producing the productivity that drives the economic engine. No one ever has the argument in the right-wing media sphere about the interests of the actual workers themselves. If you're part of a union, you're going to have higher wages than national average wage. Generally, being part of a union is a good thing if you're a worker.
Media Matters economic researcher Craig Harrington. Corporate and conservative media myths about unions create an incessant drumbeat of misinformation and lies about the labor movement that often lead to anti-union policies. Media Matters wants to set the record straight on some of those myths. Harrington says among the myths are that unions caused the auto industry's problems in Detroit, that unions reduce competitiveness, and that good union wages and benefits are driving auto and other companies to send jobs to other countries.
There's a claim that the United Auto Workers Union and unions in general were behind the collapse of the Detroit auto industry, which is blatantly false, but it's something that was an important talking point in right-wing media circles, particularly as the UAW ramped up its attempts to push for a unionization vote in Tennessee. Detroit was caused by decades of mismanagement, the forces of globalization, and general economic decline around the country in the early 2000s, and it really hit Detroit and hit Michigan hard.
Media Matters says the facts are that unions deliver positive benefits for the broader economy, they're vital to reduce inequality, and they increase productivity. New Hampshire's Republican-controlled state Senate has voted to accept federal money to expand Medicaid coverage. About 50,000 people in New Hampshire would benefit from the health protection program passed by an 18-5 margin in New Hampshire's Senate. Democrats control the state House, and the governor supports the bill. A New England College poll shows 66% of New Hampshire residents support the legislation. Tea Party Republicans, though, were and are against it. But the Republican-controlled Senate vote was consistent with widespread majority support from New Hampshire hospitals, doctors, nurses, working families, and business owners for taking that federal money to expand Medicaid. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There was a controversial remark made by a member of your legal team comparing gay marriage to the union of 12-year-olds, saying both are illegal, which you called inappropriate.
It was an inappropriate analogy. You know, I think a much better analogy would have been brother and sister, don't you?
I don't know.
Well, we need
to. I don't know.
I'll tell you, you know, when he goes in November, I think I'm going to miss him. Between that idiotic comment and the when they wanted to do the ultrasounds of women before they can get abortions, well, they don't have to look. Just turn your head. You don't have to do any of that stuff. Just turn your head. It kind of makes you go, what world are these people living in? Just bizarre to me. You know, the thing that gets me, though, is you see all of under the guise of, well, they're taking my religious freedom away. And I'm surprised Paul Ryan, when he was talking about the people, the kids whose mothers don't love them because they don't have food to put in a brown paper bag, I'm surprised he didn't say that, well, feeding those kids, that's taking away from my religious freedom. I'm surprised that didn't pop out. It's just gotten to be insane. Which is why we've asked Michael Sherrard, Executive Director of Faithful America, their website, faithfulamerica.org, with probably the greatest slogan I've seen, or tagline, love thy neighbor, no exceptions. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure, thanks for having me on.
You know, I look at this statement by Paul Ryan, and you know, I've been raging about this since I saw it. This idea that because my mother, when I was a kid growing up in the housing projects, when there was nothing in the cupboards, didn't put something in a brown paper bag for me to eat at lunchtime, somehow she didn't love me. I mean, that is just ludicrous beyond compare.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think his other line was that it was soulless, which is a fascinating word from someone who will happily advertise what a good Catholic he is.
And that's the thing that gets me. How is it? You know, because I grew up in being beaten constantly in the Catholic Church. And, you know, I was taught, you know, love thy neighbor, actually care for them, you know, feed the hungry, care for the sick, visit the imprisoned, all of that stuff. How is it that that's been completely lost in our religious discourse?
Yeah, you know, it's shameful. And really, I think Paul Ryan is sadly a textbook case of a politician who's, you know, willing to pick and choose a couple of what he thinks are the church's teaching, and just completely turned a blind eye, to, in my mind, most of the content of the gospel of Jesus Christ, which, you know, is about loving and caring for the neighbor, especially the poor and the needy among us.
But not in their world. Because, you know, and I've heard people talk about this prosperity gospel, and maybe you've got some insight, this idea that, you know, Jesus wants you to be rich and to take from everyone else because some bizarre reading of something. I'm kind of stuck by it, this idea that the hooray for me and screw everyone else is somehow the 11th commandment. I'm missing it.
Yeah, especially for Catholics. You know, I mean, it's just, there's such a rich tradition in Catholic social teaching, of the preferential option for the poor, of advancing the common good, we're all in it together, and it's shameful that, you know, that somebody like Paul Ryan would become the sort of political face of Catholic teaching so often.
You know, I look at myself as a broken Catholic. I, you know, after the beatings I endured as a child, I kind of shied away. And then they've got some other problems, too. In fact, you know, in our area, the priest always did really well. He always, somehow, the priests always got the cars that were raffled off in the church raffles. I don't know how that always happened, but they always did. And, you know, they never seemed to go without. But I'm looking at this pope that they just put into place, and I'm going, I may take a second look.
So many people, I think Catholics and non-Catholics alike, are just so tremendously inspired by what Pope Francis is saying and doing. And it's just sad that, you know, American bishops and American Catholic politicians are seemingly the last people to get it.
Yeah, I was just talking about, you know, I have friends who think we should be plastering the Ten Commandments everywhere. And my theory on it, as I went into in the last segment, is the people who want them plastered everywhere and want huge monuments and all this stuff are basically, I think, people who don't know them. They need the constant reminder to be a decent human being. And this way, you know, maybe if we did, maybe on Wall Street we remove the big bull and put a huge Ten Commandments. Maybe that one of honoring false gods, maybe the idolatry of money, as the Pope talked about. Maybe we'd be better people.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I mean, there's no better symbol for worship of money and wealth above all else in this society than that Wall Street bull.
So now I look at the Catholic Church, and I understand there's a bishop or an archbishop in New Jersey that's about to retire. Any relation to the guy in Germany who, also a cardinal, I believe, in Germany, who building palatial estates and retiring in the lap of luxury? Tell me about it.
Well, I don't know that they have any relation other than they've now both earned the same nickname, which is the Bishop of Bling. Archbishop Myers in New Jersey is really just a sad case study in how badly so many of the American bishops, not all, but so many of them, are just missing the point of what Pope Francis is saying. Here's a guy who already has a weekend home, with 6 bedrooms, and a swimming pool. He's coming up on retirement. He's 72, I think. He has to retire at age 75. And so the archdiocese has decided they need to spend $500,000 to expand his home. It's not enough to have a swimming pool outdoors. They now need to have one indoors, and a hot tub, and a library. And it just goes on and on. Meanwhile, Pope Francis is talking about how we need bishops who are animated by inner poverty. Yet again, it's gonna require, faithful Catholics, faithful Christians to stand up and assert publicly, what it is that our faith is about. Otherwise we're gonna be left with folks like Bishop Myers and Congressman Ryan.
Yeah, well,
Christianity in public.
Well, I mean, the good Archbishop there, he's got all those kids coming over.
You know, it really is unfortunate. He does have an unfortunate history with clergy sexual abuse in terms of reassigning priests, and it's just terrible that the church can't manage to get to deal forthrightly and get past that crisis, and in fact just determined to sort of keep on the embarrassment. It's really sad.
Yeah, I got to be honest.
It's especially sad for all the priests and bishops and women religious who are doing such good work in the name of the church. And are really being besmirched by just awful leadership like this.
I got to be honest, that was not quite what I meant. I meant his own children and the big family and all that. You need the extra 6 bedrooms. After I said it, I instantly regretted it. So I'm sorry about that. But I look at this and the money. Weren't they supposed to take some vow of poverty? I know the nuns do. Don't the priests on some level have to take some vow of poverty?
Strictly speaking, this gets into the complexity of Catholic canon law, and I'm not an expert, but my understanding is that members of religious orders, whether they're nuns or monks or priests who are, Jesuits or Franciscans or what have you, they take a vow of poverty. Other priests don't necessarily. That having been said, the Pope has been very clear about what he's looking for from bishops, and it's not retirement mansions with 6 bedrooms and 2 swimming pools.
Yeah, I've been saying for a while, he better not get too comfortable. He better don't let the Pope-mobile get all full of dust. They better know where that's located at all times. Because, you know, I always say about, you know, Dr. King, it was all fine, well, and good when he was talking about rights for, you know, for black people, and they should have be the right to vote and all that stuff. But when he started talking about the money, when he went down to support striking workers, that's when they put a bullet in his head.
Yeah, you know, this Pope's leadership has been really courageous in a whole host of different ways, and I think I'm not the only Christian to be praying for his health and well-being.
No, I'm right there with you. You know, but here's the thing that bothers me, Michael. You look at, in the name of religion, in the name of all of these really good things, in the name of all of this possibility, you get this really ugly divide. And I point to the most recent example, Senate Bill 1062 in Arizona that fortunately Jan Brewer vetoed, to her credit. There's not a lot that I don't give her credit for, but at least that I do, which they euphemistically called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And basically what it would do is it would say if I don't like you because I don't agree with whatever, your color, your sexual orientation, whatever, I don't have to let you come into my business. How is that restoring your religious freedom? Did I miss something?
No, I don't think you did. I like to think that I'm at least moderately familiar with the Bible, and I'm not aware of the commandment to florists, bakers, and wedding photographers saying that they should engage in discrimination. You know, it's really heinous, is what it is, that conservative politicians, having lost, frankly, the battle over marriage equality, especially with the younger generation of Americans, have now decided that they're going to flip their agenda, announce that they're the persecuted ones, and try to use religious freedom, which is something that I think all Americans value, and try to turn that into a weapon to legalize discrimination. And then they're shocked when young people run away from church. It's astounding.
Yeah, I'm with you. And this idea that, and you've hit on something that I've talked about quite often, what the right, the political right in this country does very well. They're always the victim. You listen to right-wing talk radio, they're always being attacked. They're always having something taken from them. And, you know, I think about a friend of mine. I was just talking about this on a panel I did last weekend at the Keystone Progress Progressive Summit, where he was saying that, you know, the whole gay marriage thing was ruining the sanctity of his marriage, which I would say, you know, I don't ruin anyone's marriage. But you would think that the girlfriend in Massachusetts with the kid that the wife and the two kids back in Pennsylvania don't know nothing about, that would have something to do with the sanctity of your marriage, not two people that you don't know getting married. There's this huge disconnect, but he internalized that by allowing same-sex marriage, it was ruining his marriage, even though the girlfriend and the kid, that had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, that's hard to know what to say about.
It's just one of those things that you just stop. There's nothing to say. That's ridiculous. So let me ask you then, you know, how, because the right, the political right in this country has pretty much staked their flag where they believe they're the religious authority and the religious voice of the nation. How do the folks on the left, who I believe are just as spiritual and just as committed and just as believing and faithful and all of that stuff, how do you begin to take some of that back?
Yeah, well, it's a real challenge, and I'm glad you asked, because we view that as the kind of central mission of Faithful America, is to offer Christians exactly that opportunity to try to figure out how do we band together and reclaim what it means to be a Christian in public life in the United States. I think a big part of the issue, frankly, is politicians and journalists who just haven't caught up with the reality. You know, they're you know, stuck in, I don't know, 1980 or something in the moral majority, and they just cannot wrap their heads around the fact that, you know, most American Christians, you know, first of all, their faith is about more than abortion and gay marriage. Second of all, you know, many of us believe in LGBT equality and in reproductive freedom. You know, and thirdly, you know, whatever happened to the poor and social justice as a fundamental feature of Christian faith?
They're lazy. They're lazy. They don't want to work. They just want to mooch. Is that what we hear?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. There's actually polling data showing that a shocking number of Americans believe that the Bible says that those who don't work shouldn't eat. That line is in the Bible. It's the line that people believe in the Bible is that God helps those who help themselves.
Yeah.
It doesn't appear anywhere in the Bible. I think maybe it's Benjamin Franklin or something.
Yeah, or the Chinese proverb. Or the Chinese proverb of give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day. I have people tell me that all the time. And I'll go find the, let's go get the book. You got to find that for me because I've never seen it.
Yeah, right.
So as we move down this road, because I think, you know, I think part of the problem is that the religious right has so much money. I mean, you look at these massive mega churches, and because I think they've now made religion something that's a commodity, something that you can purchase. I'm buying my way into heaven or righteousness or whatever, or, you know, like my one friend reminds me, Al Capone was probably one of the biggest donors to the Catholic Church in history, and you gotta wonder if he's in heaven or not.
That's a question for St. Peter.
There you go. And I've got a couple for him right now. But, you know, there's part of me thinks when you go back to the media structure, it comes down to the money. And you've got the religious right in this country who has so much money that they're buying so much media. They have one of the most powerful media networks in the country through radio and news and websites and newspapers and all of this because they spend heavily on it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's a product of a bunch of things, but certainly some of it is that, you know, wealthy conservative donors, you know, have seen the opportunity here for decades, you know, and have been actively and intentionally investing in building up, religious right institutions, to try to exploit Christianity for their own political purposes. And, you know, we need to make sure that, that politicians and journalists and others understand that that's happened. And B, I think on the progressive side of the equation, we need to start investing in faith a little more ourselves, and realizing that, you know, there's an opportunity here, you know, if we can actually channel, you know, what the faith actually teaches and what most Christians actually believe, you know, into our political debate a little better.
I think there's a big problem there because I think back to something Rick Santorum said, who was a congressman, senator here from Pennsylvania, also a numerous presidential. I think he's going to be a forever presidential candidate because there's money in it. But, you know, a guy said he never actually read the Bible. He just read stories about it. So I find it interesting that, and look, that's a very Catholic thing to do. I didn't read the Bible until I became the broken Catholic, because we were told what to believe. And I think a lot of it is that.
Yeah, the biblical illiteracy piece certainly is shocking among the people who are most anxious to thump the Bible. You know, it seems like there's a few parts that seem to be getting summed over quite a lot. You know, a handful of verses that may or may not refer to homosexuality. And a whole other whole lot of other parts of the Bible that aren't getting mentioned.
Yeah, everyone's hung up on Leviticus, but didn't bother to read about the one fabric clothing or the dead pig skin or any of that stuff.
Well, more about the poor. My old boss Jim Wallace, who's the editor in chief of Sojourners, he always likes to talk about his friends in seminary who decided they were going to one day go through the Bible and cut out all the references to the poor and to economic injustice. And so they spent a few hours trying to do this, and of course what they had was a Bible that was falling apart. Because this is the most consistent theme in Scripture, both in the Hebrew Scriptures and in the New Testament, is our obligation to care for the poor, the outcast, the widow. And, you know, that doesn't seem to pop up in the religious rights rhetoric very much at all.
No, not at all, especially to care for the widow. I mean, I look at Paul Ryan, to go back to that. We did. We cared for the widow. He got Social Security, a death benefit, and now he's one of these people who've turned around and said, I got it, screw you, no more for you. So let me ask you, last question I've got for you. You know, where do we go from there? What's the action? As people are listening to this going, you know, you're right. We on the sane, rational side of the political divide, we're just as faithful and spiritual and caring as they claim to be. What can we do?
Well, I think I'd say two things. One is obviously a shameless plug for my organization. You know, we're in the business of doing this all the time, of organizing petitions where Christians have the opportunity to stand up and challenge those who are exploiting and misrepresenting our faith. But the broader thing I'd say, you know, is that as progressives who are engaged in all sorts of activism and organizing for social change, you know, if you're a person of faith, don't be quiet about it. Sometimes we get this idea that somehow we're supposed to sort of you know, faith is a separate private thing that we go off and do over there and then we don't talk about very much. And simply, you know, we've seen the political consequences of that for the last few decades and how the right is able then to step in and claim that they're the only real Christians. So, you know, to quote the old song, don't hide your light under a bushel, let it shine.
There you go. Real quick, I got an email while we were talking from Jan, who said, would it be a smart thing to do if we do what they're doing in New York? Evidently, they're actually, if you'll come to church, they're auctioning off assault weapons. Weapons to come to church, is that a good tactic, you think?
I've heard about this, and I just I can't think of anything that would more seriously grieve the heart of Jesus the peacemaker. It leaves me speechless.
That's a perfect answer, Michael Sherrard. I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Michael is the executive director of Faithful America. FaithfulAmerica.org, the website. And we got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on his name. It'll take you right there. I still love the tagline. Love thy neighbor. No exceptions, Paul Ryan. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Back to America. Rick Smith.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Samantha Wyatt. Despite ongoing investigations by the FBI and the New Jersey legislature into Governor Chris Christie's involvement with the Washington Bridge scandal, Fox News is already helping Christie rehabilitate his political career. On Fox's America's Newsroom, co-host Martha McCallum painted a sunny picture of Christie's reception at CPAC, saying,
"Now you know America loves a comeback kid, so is Chris Christie that comeback kid right now?"
McCallum went on to ponder Christie's 2016 presidential prospects.
And then you have Chris Christie, who says, "Look, you know what? We have to win election as somebody who may have an easier time of it on a national stage."
Fox has gone to extraordinary lengths to shield Christie, who is widely presumed to be running for president in 2016, from the scandal's fallout. The day the Bridgegate scandal broke, CNN and MSNBC each gave the story more than 2 hours of coverage, but Fox News buried the Christie scandal with barely 15 minutes of coverage. Fox's history of cozy relationships with Republican presidential contenders is well documented, and it appears they intend to keep it that way. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Okay, climate change deniers, you've gone too far. You've gone from just being annoying know-nothings to now posing a serious threat to an essential good that embodies humankind's finest collaboration with nature, beer. It's one thing for the science denial cult to stand in the way of doing something about melting ice caps in the Arctic, but it's another thing altogether for them to mess with beer. This makes it personal. While the deniers keep doing their denial dance, California is drying up. The higher temperatures caused by climate change has produced an ongoing drought that has, among other bad things, caused a precipitous drop in the water level of Lake Mendocino, which could come close to being a dry lake bed this summer. What has that got to do with beer? Glad you asked. Mendocino feeds the Russian River, which flows by the town of Petaluma, home of Lagunitas Brewing Company, which makes very fine beers. A key ingredient in the Lagunitas brew is the excellent water the company draws from the Russian River, which presently is in danger of becoming a trickle. Can't Lagunitas and other breweries along the river just switch to groundwater? No. The head beermaster at Lagunitas notes that heavy minerals in that water would cause it to fizz in the brewing process. Plus, there are concentrations of nitrates, iron, and manganese in the area's groundwater, creating issues of odor, taste, and other unpleasantries that do not add up to good beer. This is Jim Hightower saying, what the Lagunitas experience is teaching us once again is that the nature of nature is that all things are linked together, despite the fantasies of industry shills who insist that their contaminants have no dire consequences. Mess with the global climate, and you mess with Lake Mendocino, which messes with the Russian River, which messes with the beer. And now, you're messing with me and millions of other beer drinkers. Like I said, it's personal.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Michael Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, I think Michael's, I think he's right. And, you know, it's one of those things that I think the good, decent people who I think there are across the political spectrum on the religious front, good, decent people. The problem is it's the loudest ones. And I think, you know, I look at these huge mega churches where there's just so much money that's being collected that we could do, that could, so much good work could be done. And they do a little, you know, just gotta do the show. But you look at this and you go, you know, I'm sorry, I'm not saying that it's enough. You see these televangelists, man, and some of these crooks, and the amount of money that they siphon out of, especially poor people, is, to me, it's just criminal. Honestly, it's just, that's the best I can come up with. It's just criminal. And what frustrates me is that we subsidize all this. We give huge, massive tax breaks to perpetuate this insanity. And I've often said, you know, where is that Catholic church that I grew up in? While the nuns were not the nicest, especially to me, the ideology of the church, the direction, the things that they, maybe it was just my neighborhood. Maybe it was because we were such a poor neighborhood. But understand that the parish was fairly diverse. There was a divide, and it was the divide was actually, now that I think about it, Puritas, right there is where the divide was between where the projects were and where you started to get into the lower working class type homes. And then several blocks down the road, you got into the fairly well-to-do neighborhoods. So the church had a draw of all of those people. And it talked about, you know, community and talked about helping thy neighbor. And I love that. Love thy neighbor. No exceptions. And you look at that religious freedom bill, which I find hysterical.
The Religious Restoration Act.
Like somehow that someone's stealing their right to discriminate. I was just watching a clip of one of my favorite comedians back in the 80s, a guy named Kip Adada, who probably nobody's ever heard of, but he did some really cool songs that I loved back in the 80s. And he did a bit that, you know, I had forgotten about. It's one of those, I'd seen his stand-up routine several times because, you know, I had done some door work at one of the comedy clubs. And I remember him going to during his act, pointing at a guy going, heterosexual, right? And the guy shakes his head, he goes, yeah, I can spot him, just like that. I can spot him. And it's kind of the same thing. How do you know so that you can discriminate? I understand, you know, you're going to discriminate against black people because you can see that. But on the sexual orientation, in fact, you know, I just found out a guy I've known for a while, as long as I've been doing this program, that he was gay. And do I care? No. But I just found that out. I was like, wow, I would have never guessed. And nor should I have until he told me. And then I didn't go running and screaming for the woods. He's a nice guy. Does good work. Maybe if we all had that kind of mentality. Just a thought. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
And they're talking in the town where it's a time to shout it. I hear them talking everywhere. They're talking never stop. But all their words of wisdom won't make you go away. The day they call for back, we're down and nothing.
your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a settlement with New York's Attorney General, owners of Lage Car Washes in New York City will pay $3.9 million for unpaid wages and underreporting of employees on state unemployment and workers' compensation forms. The Retail Worker Union, RWDSU, and Community Allies are waging an anti-wage theft campaign that highlighted these abuses. The car wash chains will pay $2.2 million to 1,000 workers for nearly 6 years of unpaid wages owed them. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says that when workers like these stand up for their rights, they need to know that state and city leaders will stand behind them.
Unions exist to encourage economic growth and try to spread some of that prosperity to the workers who are out there producing the productivity that drives the economic engine. No one ever has the argument in the right-wing media sphere about the interests of the actual workers themselves. If you are part of a union, you're going to have higher wages than national average wage. Generally, being part of a union is a good thing if you're a worker.
Media Matters economic researcher Craig Harrington. Corporate and conservative media myths about unions create an incessant drumbeat of misinformation and lies about the labor movement that often lead to anti-union policies. Media Matters wants to set the record straight on some of those myths. Harrington says among the myths are that unions caused the auto industry's problems in Detroit, that unions reduce competitiveness, and that good union wages and benefits are driving auto and other companies to send jobs to other countries.
There's a claim that the United Auto Workers Union and union in general were behind the collapse of the Detroit auto industry, which is blatantly false. But it's something that was an important talking point in right-wing media circles, particularly as the UAW ramped up its attempts to push for a unionization vote in Tennessee. Detroit was caused by the mismanagement, the forces of globalization, and general economic decline around the country in the early 2000s, and it really hit Detroit and hit Michigan hard.
Media Matters says the facts are that unions deliver positive benefits for the broader economy, they're vital to reduce inequality, and they increase productivity. New Hampshire's Republican-controlled state Senate has voted to accept federal money to expand Medicaid coverage. About 50,000 people in New Hampshire would benefit from the health protection program passed by an 18-5 margin in New Hampshire's Senate. Democrats control the state House, and the governor supports the bill. A New England College poll shows 66% of New Hampshire residents support the legislation. Tea Party Republicans, though, were and are against it. But the Republican-controlled Senate vote was consistent with widespread majority support from New Hampshire hospitals, doctors, nurses, working families, and business owners for taking that federal money to expand Medicaid. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Minimum wage!
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you is like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Oh, man, you know, if that isn't the absolute truth, I mean, stop and think about it for a minute. You know, you look at some of these industries that have propped up. I mean, you look at the restaurant industry where the minimum wage is like $2.13 an hour, and you still see cases of wage theft. And, you know, for me, here in Pennsylvania, they keep talking about this paycheck protection, which you got to love that. Because who could possibly be against protecting someone's paycheck, right? I'm not against it. But I asked the question of the people who proposed this stuff, does it stop against wage theft? Well, no. Does it stop against hour theft? Does it stop against making you work again through your break? Does it stop against misclassifying people as independent contractors? Well, no. Then what are you protecting? Oh, yeah, protecting you from the workers having a voice to be able to stand up and say no, which is why I am glad to see all across this country organizing drives, pushing back against the status quo. And right now, our friends at the Teamsters are doing just amazing work in Georgia, down in Savannah, one of my favorite places, with the port truck drivers down there trying to get these drivers who, I saw the numbers on this. You've got some of these guys who are working for like $7-8 an hour, driving an 18-wheeler for $7-8 an hour. Because they're their own boss. You gotta love that. You gotta love that friend. Which is why we've asked John Jackson. He is one of the port truck drivers down there. He works for the Cal Cartage Company down in Savannah, Georgia. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Yes.
You know, I look
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. You know, I look at this, and I've talked to a number of people. As someone who drove a truck for a number of years, was a Teamster for 20 years, I want everyone to have the same benefits I had as a driver. The ability to have good wages, good benefits, and good safe equipment, and the ability to say, no, I'm not going to drive this garbage. But I look at what's happened to the trucking industry over the last 20, 30 years of my working life, and it's deplorable. And now I find that most of the people that are in the trucking industry are this independent contractor. So I wanted to explore this a little bit with you. How did you get into this? How did you get in working to the company you're in this classification?
Well, actually, I came into it. It was already established when I got into it, but it's just something that dragged the drivers down. I say we work in an industry that we're not a part of. We support an industry that we're not a part of. We don't have a future in it. We break down. I mean, we get sick. We break. We have a serious breakdown. We can pretty much be out of business because we work from week to week. You know, we count our check. We hoping we have a good week to take care of just simple business. You know, just to be able to survive. And that's wrong. And I've been in it myself for 23 years, and it's gotten worse. Because everything now is put on to the driver.
Yeah,
yes, I'm sorry.
No, I'm curious how you got into this. Because, you know, you go and apply for a job. How is it that you end up, how did you get into this? Is, I guess, the question that I'm asking first. Or was it just you didn't have a choice? Or was it just this was all that you could find, and this was it? Because as I understand, you know, this whole thing is you end up leasing your truck, right?
Yes, I lease to a company, yes.
And you work for that company that you lease from, and you have to follow the rules of that company, correct?
Well, yeah, they have it laid out. They have what they call a lease agreement, and they have everything laid out as to what you get paid, you know, and it's not meeting our, you know, just in order for us to make us a decent living. It's more or less looking out for the company.
Yeah.
But yes, we come into a program that's already established, and I don't know when or how it got established, but it didn't have the driver in mind.
Yeah, well, it's got shifting the responsibility of the costs and all the risk and all the responsibility onto the driver and away from the company. I mean, if you can get it, it's a good gig, right?
Yes.
If you're the company, that's a great gig. Somebody else takes all the responsibilities. I get to make all the profit. That's a great gig. But for the workers, it's a screw job.
Yes, it is. It's a stressful job for the worker. You know, because it's just so much that you're responsible for, and you're not getting compensated for it.
So let me ask you the question that I get from because I've talked to a number of drivers over the last couple of years, you know, out in Los Angeles first, and now here in Georgia, and the question I get often is if you're in this situation, you're now this quote unquote independent contractor, you're your own boss. Of course, you've got all of the headaches and very little of the rewards. Why would you stay? You know, is this the only job that's available? Because this is the question I get often. Now, I'm of the mindset, just before you answer, I'm of the mindset you never walk away from a bad situation. You make a bad situation better. That's my view. But I'm curious what your thought is.
Well, I stay in it because I love to drive. I just want to get a fair wage for what I do. You know, just like anybody else have a job that they do. Sure, you can get into something else, but you like to do what you're happy at. That's where you're most productive at, and it's what you're happy in doing. But our situation is that we just don't get compensated for the responsibility that we have, because everything, if something go wrong, any write-ups or whatever, we're responsible for them boxes, you know, once we hook them to our trucks. And we just don't get compensated for that.
So walk me through it. So as an independent contractor, as your own boss, because they love that. Mm-hmm. They love throwing that out. You're going to be your own boss, John. And along with being your own boss, you have to pay for your own insurance, right?
Yes.
You have to pay for the insurance on their trailer, right?
Yes. Well, not on that trailer, on your truck, you have a collision and all on your truck, and you have to have insurance, bobtail insurance. But when you hook up to a box, they got something they call cargo insurance, which we don't have to have cargo insurance. But once we hook up to their box, we cover it under their cargo insurance.
Okay.
But it's just the responsibility that come along with the hauling of these trailers.
Right.
Like DOT stop us, they find something wrong with the trailers, they want to put it against us. Damage done to these trailers, these companies, they turn it over to the driver, which we don't do. We're responsible for trying to keep our truck up. And sometimes we charge for stuff that's wrong with their equipment, which is wrong.
So, in essence, what you're saying is you've got all the costs. You've got to keep up the tractor that you've got. You've got to keep up all of this stuff, all the paperwork, everything that goes with it. And for all of that headache, all of that trouble, what on a yearly basis do you bring home to take care of your family?
You don't bring home half of what you make, because by the time you take out all the deductions for what you have to do in order to stay in business, you don't bring home half of what you make. It's just sometimes you might bring home like in the 20 or low 20s. You know, it all depends on how your year goes.
Yeah,
this is a up and go business.
You know, I see the ads all over the place. Yeah, first year, come out of truck driving school, make $45,000 a year. So we're told that, you know, hey, these lease op agreements, these are wonderful things. They're fantastic. Going to make huge money. Going to be my own boss, king of the open road, huge paychecks. But what I'm hearing from you, not so much.
No, it's not. Every year we end up in the red every year. You know, I've been into it. 23 years, and each year I'm starting out on the bottom of the totem pole, struggling, trying to maintain and just make a decent living, and it's just time for that to change, you know.
So what are you guys doing? What are you guys doing to change that?
Well, we're working with the Teamsters and trying to get some laws changed here in Georgia. You know, we got a bill that we're trying to get passed, which was introduced to the Georgia legislature on the 26th, and we're just trying to do it the legal way, because we done spent a lot of time on side of the road trying to get it done, and these companies promise us that they're going to, well, they'll promise us something, but we don't have it locked in because we don't have it written down, so they, once everything go to flowing good, they take it back, you know, so we're not trying to go that route anymore. We're trying to do it the legal way and get some laws changed. And through the Teamsters, we have went a long way. We have never been to where we got it out to where the public can hear us, hear our cry. And this time, a lot of people have heard our cry because of the Teamsters telling us the direction to go in and helping us with it, because we just didn't have that know-how before.
You know, I've gotten a number of responses from listeners who said, you know, I didn't realize that the people in this industry are in the situations that they're in, that these guys, that these sweatshop on wheels that are right racing up and down the road, that, you know, these folks, you know, they're trying to make a living like anyone else, and they're put in a horrible situation. And I always take it back to the root cause, which in my view is this, all of this insane deregulation, all of the assaults on our labor laws and antiquated, outdated labor law that allows someone like you, who is by clearly, in my view, an employee to be exploited and manipulated in such a way that you're the one carrying the burden, you're the one carrying the cost, and the company's the one that's benefiting from it.
Yes, yes, they is. They benefiting big time. They don't have any overhead now. Under this system, they don't have any overhead now. All the overhead that went to the driver now. So, sure, they're making a good profit because they don't have any expense. And And under these present conditions, there's nothing we can do about it, you know. So that's why we're trying to get all this changed.
And that's why we're behind you guys 100%. And I think it's so important. I think it's vital to hear stories like yours so that people understand that, you know what, we all truly are all in this together. Because if we allow someone, if we let you, John Jackson, be exploited by this company, at some point the company that I work for is going to go, hey, I like their business model. We're going to have Rick Smith work that way. Or we're going to have John Jones work that way or whoever. And eventually it's all of us. It's all of us that are at the bottom of the barrel once the spiral ends up collapsing. And why I give folks like you the utmost credit for standing up, because, you know, especially you guys who are classified independent contractors, because as I understand it, and this is where I think our labor law is so screwed up, as an independent contractor, you don't really have any rights, even in an at-will state, really, do you?
No, we can't even... negotiate a price, you know, that will really help us. Give us a decent wage. We can't even, they want to get us for antitrust laws if we come together to try to even just get enough money to take care of the expenses that we have as an owner operator. So we don't have any right. We don't fall under it. If you go to different places, they say you don't fall under the labor laws, so it's just a mess. The way that system is set up.
You guys are working outrageous numbers of hours, and there is no work, as I understand it. Correct me if I'm wrong. You can't take your truck that you're leasing that is supposed to be yours because you're your own man. You're your own business. You're an independent contractor. You can't take that truck and go work for somebody else.
No, you can't.
But I thought it was your truck.
Yeah, but it's not as easy as you think it is to really go somewhere else, because this work is seasonal work. So when one operation get work, all the other ones get work. So it's not as easy as people may make it sound to go somewhere else, because they all get to work at the same time. So when your truck company builds get work, the other company's getting work. So that's how they hide behind that, saying you can go to other companies to work. But really you can't, because there's no work to go to. So you're stuck. You're stuck to a place, you know, until stuff picks back up.
And in there is the answer of, you know, I have people constantly going, why didn't you just go work for another company or go somewhere else? Reality check, folks, they're all doing it. It's all virtually the entire industry has gone to this model. Most of the trucks you see riding up and down the roads, independent contractors who've been hogtied into these lease agreements.
Yes.
So last question I've got for you on these agreements. Can you, at some point, can you opt out of this? Are you financially tied to them? It's a question I really don't know. Because there's part of me that thinks if you're tied to them for a period of time with huge financial consequences, that, you know, I don't know how much difference that is to slavery then.
Well, you can always cancel your lease if. You can always go to somewhere else to work. They can't. You tie it to them, but see what makes it so different is they can cancel you out anytime, but they kind of want you to give them a notice if you cancel out. They can come to you today if they don't like what you're doing and tell you your lease is canceled. You know, you no longer need it. But when it's time for you want to decide you might want to leave, they want you to give them a notice. Or they'll get you a bad rep. If you go to another company, they may put on there that you quit, or, you know, whatever the reason might be. It won't be a good report as far as you putting them down for a reference. Or either they give you a bad report. But when it comes to them doing you, you know, wanting to get rid of you, all they just say, we canceling your lease, and wow, you out of there.
Wow. And here, I thought you were your own boss. You had your own truck. It's yours.
Yes.
Wow, what a scam.
To a certain extent.
What a scam.
Yeah.
John Jackson, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thank you for sharing your story. You know, I, I'm I'm with you guys. Whatever we can do here at the Rick Smith Show to help, we are all in favor. We are all behind you, and I give you nothing but the utmost credit, and all of your coworkers the utmost credit for standing up and saying enough is enough.
Yes, sir. I appreciate you too taking the time out to help us get all our voice out and getting our word out as to what we have, that we are enduring.
Solidarity, brother. One day longer. One day longer. Thank you, John Jackson. I'll take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no. They're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in their new world. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Standing up to conservatives every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
So now you see the light, hey, stand up for your rights. Come on, get up, stand up, stand up for your rights.
You know, I got to tell you, you listen to someone like John Jackson, and I give the guy nothing but the utmost credit. Huge stones. I mean, really, honestly and truthfully, to be able to stand up and say, you know what, in the face of, as he pointed out, at any minute, For no reason, they can cancel his contract for any minute. And for him to step forward and say, you know what, the situation is unacceptable, it's wrong, and it has to be changed, to me, just remarkable, just amazing in my view, that you have people in this country who are willing to stand up and fight against overwhelming power. And for me, that's what draws me to the labor movement. Why, you know, during my years carrying a Teamster union card, I was advocating that everyone should have that right. everyone should have that voice on the job. Everyone should have the ability to, and this is just pure simple America. Access to that American dream, access to that middle class. If you're willing, and look, if we're going to use that frame, and they use it a lot, you know, if you work hard, you play by the rules, you should be able to get ahead. Well, damn right you should. At the minimum. But for too often, what we've allowed is we've allowed the entrepreneurs. We've let the entrepreneurs come up with these schemes that end up shafting good, decent, hardworking Americans every day. And we've got a legal system that allows it and a political class that almost encourages it so that they can get a campaign contribution. I keep asking, how much more? How much more are we willing to take? How much more are you willing to eat? How much more of you-know-what are you willing to eat? Unfortunately, there are people like John Jackson and people like Miss Colley that we talked to a couple of weeks ago and the other drivers that we've talked to. You know, I hear people who know nothing about the trucking industry. You know, I go to dinner parties and stuff, and they're always complaining, oh, those trucks, they're just unbearable. Yeah, because you're in their way. These are folks who, they're struggling, man. Let's quick go to the phone lines. Well, maybe afterwards. But I look at this and I go, there are people who are willing to stand up and say enough's enough already. And I give these people credit. It's just that simple. And, you know, in the aftermath, and what I hope is coming, is a number of folks who are just, enough's enough, we're going to begin to put an end to this kind of abuse. And, you know, from a legal standpoint first, but from a societal standpoint, my grandparents' generation, they would have never stood for that. And it wouldn't have just been the people who worked for that company. It would have been everybody who drove a truck. It would have been all of those folks who are in that industry because, again, my grandparents' generation, they understood that an injury to one is most certainly an injury to all. And we need to get that back. We honestly and truthfully, we need to get that back. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher, on the smartphone. We do that. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you've got any questions, comments, thoughts on this, thoughts on the Paul Ryan thing. I mean, all of this stuff intricately linked. All of this stuff, stuff that I think, you know, we really, honestly and truthfully need to be fighting back over and saying, you know, no more. Quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a settlement with New York's Attorney General, owners of Lage Car Washes in New York City will pay $3.9 million for unpaid wages and underreporting of employees on state unemployment and workers' compensation forms. The Retail Worker Union, RWDSU, and Community Allies are waging an anti-wage theft campaign that highlighted these abuses. The car wash chains will pay $2.2 million to 1,000 workers for nearly 6 years of unpaid wages owed them. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says that when workers like these stand up for their rights, they need to know that state and city leaders will stand behind them.
Unions exist to encourage economic growth and try to spread some of that prosperity to the workers who are out there producing the productivity that drives the economic engine. No one ever has the argument in the right-wing media sphere about the interests of the actual workers themselves. If you are part of a union, you're going to have higher wages than national average wage. Generally, being part of a union is a good thing if you're a worker.
Media Matters economic researcher Craig Harrington.
Corporate and conservative media myths about unions create an incessant drumbeat of misinformation and lies about the labor movement that often lead to anti-union policies. Media Matters wants to set the record straight on some of those myths. Harrington says among the myths are that unions caused the auto industry's problems in Detroit, that unions reduce competitiveness, and that good union wages and benefits are driving auto and other companies to send jobs to other countries.
There's a claim that the United Auto Workers Union and union in general were behind the collapse of the Detroit auto industry, which is blatantly false, but it's something that was an important talking point in right-wing media circles, particularly as the UAW ramped up its attempts to push for a unionization vote in Tennessee. Detroit was caused by decades of mismanagement, the forces of globalization, and general economic decline around the country in the early 2000s, and it really hit Detroit and hit Michigan hard.
Media Matters says the facts are that unions deliver positive benefits for the broader economy, they're vital to reduce inequality, and they increase productivity. New Hampshire's Republican-controlled state Senate has voted to accept federal money to expand Medicaid coverage. About 50,000 people in New Hampshire would benefit from the health protection program passed by an 18-5 margin in New Hampshire's Senate. Democrats control the state House, and the governor supports the bill. A New England College poll shows 66% of New Hampshire residents support the legislation. Tea Party Republicans, though, were and are against it. But the Republican-controlled Senate vote was consistent with widespread majority support from New Hampshire hospitals, doctors, nurses, working families, and business owners for taking that federal money to expand Medicaid. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
In the factories and the fields, in the city streets and the quiet country towns.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Yeah, I got to tell you, I wish I could make it to the big circus there in D.C. with the conservative political action committees. Cattle call. It just is what I can't help. A couple of the stories I saw, just mind-blowing. And you go, these people have the right to vote. And I would fight for that. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in the good area there. Also, with some big job numbers, I've got Isaiah Poole on the line. He's the editor of the Our Future blog, ourfuture.org, the website. Isaiah, thanks for taking time for us.
Appreciate it.
So some decent job numbers came out today.
Kind of decent. But here's the context. 175,000 new jobs were created, which was, some people expected that number to be a bit lower than that. So some people were positively surprised by 175,000. But this is the thing that I always tell people, and we've said this on our blog before. We should be running at twice that number, about 350,000 jobs a month, not 175,000.
Right.
The reason being that the hole that was created, the crater that was created by the recession, was about 8 million jobs. At the rate we're going, it will be the rest of the decade before we climb out. And that's just simply not good enough.
And not to mention, just to keep up with demographics, just to keep up with the growth of our nation.
Precisely.
You've got to be creating at least what we've created this month so we don't fall behind this month. I got to be honest, I was expecting much lower numbers because of the weather, because of, you know, just the insanity going on in Congress, the fact that the Congress ran off at Christmas time and didn't extend unemployment. I was expecting for something a little worse.
So was I, and actually the unemployment rate went up just a tick to 6.7%. Precisely because there were people who were beginning to edge back into the labor market and to try to look for work as we kind of get closer to spring. We're probably going to see, if people start, who are sort of on the margins, try to get back into the workforce, we may actually see more numbers like this where the unemployment rate kind of goes up because the more people who look but don't find anything, that's part of the reason unemployment rate goes up,
right,
even when you're creating new jobs. But the other thing that this says is that if we were able to do this with literally one hand of the economy tied behind its back. Imagine what we would be able to do if we were not in this austerity frame that conservatives have forced us into. If we were actually had a government that was investing in jobs, if we the other thing that is important to know, the government came out this week with new trade numbers, and our trade deficit right now is running at $39 billion in December. And Dave Johnson, who I know you've had on your show before from our team, points out that imagine what would happen if American businesses had $39 billion worth of business, that goods and services that it had to produce in December.
Yeah. No, I've asked that question a number of times, Isaiah. You know, and it comes, for me, a lot of this comes back down to our trade deals. And you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that is being muddled around in secret behind closed doors, to me, is a huge concern because, you know, as you pointed out, nearly a $40 billion in 1 month trade deficit.
Yeah.
How much worse is it going to get?
You know, if what we heard about what's in the Trans-Pacific Partnership comes true, it could get a lot worse. And that's the problem. And that's why there's been so much resistance against it, why Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi have put the brakes on this thing, fortunately. You know, we will see if this becomes one of those things where it's sort of parked until after the elections, and then it sort of runs through on a lame duck.
That's what I worry about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real fear. But I think what we need to do is keep the pressure up. We cannot afford these high trade deficits. We have to be able to do something to incentivize American manufacturing, incentivize American production. And one of the things that the Trans-Pacific Partnership will keep us from doing is having the federal government say, for example, that when it comes to spending American tax dollars, we're going to spend American tax dollars with American businesses making American goods.
Yeah, well, that would be an unfair trade restriction there, Isaiah. We can't do that. That's that's part of the whole premise of free trade, that you can have no national loyalties. You can't say that, you know, the company in my backyard that has, you know, workers paying taxes into my local government, we should support them. Can't do that. That would be bad.
But I think even Tea Party Republicans would agree. And in fact, some of the polling I've seen suggests that even Tea Party Republicans would agree that when you spend American taxpayer dollars, those American taxpayer dollars should support American jobs first. It's great that we have a trade regime that boosts other countries. We want people in other countries to do well. And in fact, that's why we fight for the environmental protections. That's why we fight for worker empowerment, the right for workers in other countries to form unions if that's what they want to do, those kinds of things. We want workers in China and in other parts of Asia and India and Eastern Europe and Mexico and South America to do well. But we want America to do well as well. And we have a jobs crisis in this country. That is what the numbers today told us. They reaffirm the jobs crisis that we have in America. And we cannot afford to have a trade deal that does not allow us to address that jobs crisis.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it comes down to that dreaded I word that conservatives seem to despise so much, investment. You know, I live in a neighborhood, and everything, I think, has to come back to how individuals see things. And, you know, even in my neighborhood, I live in a very conservative area. Even my most right-wing conservative friends agree that the broadband access, the internet access in our neighborhood, is deplorable. I mean, we're in third world type conditions. I mean, it's almost dial-up. That's how bad it is. And it's
I can tell you a story. If I go to my father-in-law's house in upstate New York, that's exactly what he has as well. And it's not, you know, I'm fortunate enough to live in an urban area. But even in the urban area that I live in, I have two options for broadband access, both of which are very expensive. And, you know, that is that, you know, and when you look at what the average person has in the more developed parts of Europe, that's a shame.
Yeah, it is. And the reason I bring that up, and it is my personal pet peeve and my mission to get this changed, the reason I bring this up, if we're told this is the future, if this is told my kids are going to learn on the Internet, this is where the future is, if we're told this and we believe it and it's real, then why aren't we investing heavily in it? Because, you know, even in the best of neighborhoods, like, you know, I live in a pretty good neighborhood, we're hampered by the fact that it's not there. And the free market isn't bringing it there because they've already got us. We've got crummy Internet. We can't do anything about it. So where's the competition? Where's this whole free market ideology at work? Well, it's at work. It's at work screwing me.
Right, right. So here's what we need to do, I think. We know that the market is not working to provide the services that we need, to provide the innovation that we need. One of the ways that we can get at that is through the tax code. The Republicans put out a tax reform proposal this week. And there are, frankly, a couple elements in it are decent. There are some things in there that actually progressives have been fighting for, but it's not good enough. And frankly, President Obama's tax reform proposal, while they are much better than what the Republicans have put on the table, are not bold enough. What we need is tax reform that, number one, incentivizes investment in America and does not reward outsourcing overseas. We need a tax reform proposal that does not lock in the erosion of taxes that have been paid by the top 1%. The top 1% in this country pay less as a percentage of the economy today than they did 30 years ago. And what that means is that those of us who are working class people are actually shouldering more of the burden. And that's especially true when you look at the fact that there are big corporations like Verizon and Comcast, let's just name it, put those names right on the table there, who are barely paying any taxes at all.
And in fact, in some instances, we're actually paying them to exist.
Exactly.
I mean, I look at General Electric. We actually pay them money to exist. And, that, you know, you go, explain to me how that's a good thing, especially because if we're supposed to be a free market, we're supposed to be, we the people, government's supposed to be neutral. How is it that giving one company money over another, how is it that is not infringing on the quote-unquote free market?
And especially when the Obama administration made the decision that it wanted to invest money in renewable energy. It wanted to get some renewable energy companies launched so that they can stand on their own 2 feet. And one of them failed, Solyndra. And the response was, well, the government should get out of the business of picking winners and losers, when in fact conservative policies, conservative tax policy in particular, has been picking winners and losers all the time.
Yeah.
Conservative tax policies enable the fossil fuels industry to be a winner in the economy, even though what we need to be doing is encouraging these new industries, wind and solar and other renewable, sustainable energy sources. We need those. We need to have a robust battery energy, innovative battery energy industry forming so that we can have things like electric cars and other good battery applications.
And be able to store solar and be able to store some energy as well.
Exactly.
I'm right there with you. And the problem is we don't have that I word. It's been eradicated from our vocabulary. Investment, looking towards the future. And I look at this circus going on in D.C. right now, this CPAC conference, and, you know, any vision going to come out of this thing, or is it going to be just more patting each other on the back and, oh, we're right, it's all those nasty liberals like Isaiah Poole, it's those nasty groups like Our Future who are taking from us and holding us back, Any ideas going to come out of this? Because, you know, to be honest, I've seen no new ideas come out of the conservative movement since well before Reagan. I mean, it's the same rehash, retread of bad idea after bad idea that we know fail.
A good example of that actually was the War on Poverty report that Congressman Paul Ryan introduced this week. He took that report, by the way, to the CPAC conference and gave a speech on how we failed on the war of poverty and how we need to, you know, he says that he's coming up with new ideas, but, you know, I've read the document. The document is a critique of all of the federal programs that are used to help low-income people. And what's come out in the days since that report was released was that he cherry-picked research.
Yep.
He mischaracterized some of the research, and some of the people that he quoted have come out and said that their data was misconstrued. So,
but isn't this what happens when you start off? You start at the end and work your way back. You start with the conclusion. You know what you want. You know what the ideology is. You know what you need to get to, and then you go back and you cherry pick what you need. I mean, it's kind of like. You know, we knew we were going into Iraq. We knew it was going to happen. We just had to find stuff like tubes and cake.
Well, exactly. And one of the preconceptions that Ryan walked into was the notion that because there is a high rate of single parenthood in low-income families, that somehow the solution is that if you get these folk married, they'll be less likely to be in poverty. And as I had to point out, correlation is not causation.
Right.
And in fact, there are studies that Ryan did not cite in his report that says that the marriage programs that the federal government spent hundreds of millions of dollars in through the Bush administration and even before, those marriage programs basically did not make a significant difference.
Right.
In fact, you take a poor woman and you marry a poor woman to a poor man, and you don't fix the economic circumstances or the economic options that that man and that woman have, you know, you've just created you're most likely have created a worse situation. You've created certainly an economically unstable marriage. And in fact, you also have an unstable marriage spiritually and emotionally as well.
And anybody who knows anything about divorce, the majority of divorces happen because you don't have any money. People are fighting because they're broke.
So it comes back around full circle to what we started to talk about at the very beginning, which is that if you look at the breadth of jobs that existed for people.
Yep.
Back in the 1960s and in the early 1970s, if you wanted to, if all you had was a high school diploma and maybe some community college, you still had a lot of options out there. You could go into a manufacturing plant. There were lots of options for finding decent work that could support a family. We need to start having a policy. Industrial policy that gives us those options back. We need to bring some of the stuff that we've outsourced back into this country, and we can do that in a way that is futuristic, that through focusing on our capacity to innovate, our capacity to build new industries, our need to start thinking about the energy, how we're going to get energy in a way that does not exacerbate climate change, which opens up things like weatherization, opens up the other installations of solar panels, wind farms, these kinds of things. We can build a whole new spectrum of jobs that range from jobs that require master's degrees down to jobs that only require a high school diploma. But we have to be smart, and we have to be bold about what we want to do. We have to step on some of the old toes that are in the way right now in order to get there.
And young ones like Paul Ryan's. The thing is, it comes down to jobs. And this is where I think people, when they voted for Republicans heavily in 2010, the message of laser-like focus, jobs, 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 that's what it was all about. They've done everything but look at jobs. The last question I've got for just a quick opinion on the brown bag statement, the brown bag story. that Paul Ryan brought up. I was disgusted by it, but to be honest with you. But I'm curious what your thought was.
We've just posted on our site, by the way, an excellent article by Terrence Heath, and people should go to ourfuture.org and read it, because it's about empty stomachs and empty rhetoric. The brown bag story, listen, I was a kid who was on free lunch. I know what that's like.
I do too.
The humiliation that Republicans in various states now want to heap on low-income children who are getting free lunch sickens me. You cannot, whatever you think of parents, yes, there's a parent or two out there. There are some parents who probably aren't doing all that they need to do. But I tell you, there are a bunch of rich parents who don't do what they need to do either.
I'm with you.
The fact that you are a rich kid doesn't make you morally superior to a kid from a low-income family.
It doesn't mean that the parents love their kids any less. And that's what grabbed me. How dare you? How dare you, you sanctimonious, self-righteous, pompous, you know what, have the audacity, the unmitigated gall to say that because my mother, when I was a kid, couldn't afford to put food on the table because there were no jobs and we weren't on the bus line because I couldn't carry a brown bag to lunch, that somehow she loved me any less. That, if ever someone needed to get smacked, right then and there.
Absolutely, absolutely. Where is our compassion? Where is our sense of dignity? Where is our sense of, you know, I am really angry about that. And maybe it's improper for me to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. There has always been a tendency, an ugly, nasty, dark tendency in America to try to get gain from people who are voiceless and defenseless, to render people voiceless and defenseless, and then to exploit them.
Sure, that's profit. That's capitalism,
see,
my friend.
The worst manifestation of that was slavery. The worst manifestation of that. But even we got rid of slavery, but the impulse to exploit the voiceless and defenseless is not out of our system. And that is why there are people among us who are willing to say things, as Newt Gingrich, for example, did, and as several other political leaders have said.
Get those welfare kids to clean the toilets.
Get the welfare kids to clean the toilets. You know, I will get into a lot of trouble for saying that that comes out of the same impulse as our impulse to enslave people came from. But, you know, tell me something else.
Yeah. It's who they are to their core, and I've always believed that these are the people who take great joy off of other people's pain and misery. It just is what it is. But Isaiah, I appreciate you taking time for us. I appreciate your insight, your thoughts, and the numbers on the job stuff. We got a lot of work to do.
We have a lot of work to do.
All righty.
So I appreciate you being in the fight with us.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Isaiah. We'll see you next Friday. Let's take a quick break. It is Our Future Friday. Again, the website, ourfuture.org. The good folks over at the Campaign for America's Future. Thanks so much, Isaiah Poole. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
To the last of us.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you plow in snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Okay, climate change deniers, you've gone too far.
You've gone from just being annoying know-nothings to now posing a serious threat to an essential good that embodies humankind's finest collaboration with nature, beer. It's one thing for the science denial cult to stand in the way of doing something about melting ice caps in the Arctic, but it's another thing altogether for them to mess with beer. This makes it personal. While the deniers keep doing their denial dance, California is drying up. The higher temperatures caused by climate change has produced an ongoing drought that has, among other bad things, caused a precipitous drop in the water level of Lake Mendocino, which could come close to being a dry lake bed this summer. What has that got to do with beer? Glad you asked. Mendocino feeds the Russian River, which flows by the town of Petaluma, home of Lagunitas Brewing Company, which makes very fine beers. A key ingredient in the Lagunitas brew is the excellent water the company draws from the Russian River, which presently is in danger of becoming a trickle. Can't Lagunitas and other breweries along the river just switch to groundwater? No. The head beermaster at Lagunitas notes that heavy minerals in that water would cause it to fizz in the brewing process. Plus, there are concentrations of nitrates, iron, and manganese in the area's groundwater, creating issues of odor, taste, and other unpleasantries that do not add up to good beer. This is Jim Hightower saying, what the Lagunitas experience is teaching us once again is that the nature of nature is that all things are linked together, despite the fantasies of industry shills who insist that their contaminants have no dire consequences. Mess with the global climate, and you mess with Lake Mendocino, which messes with the Russian River, which messes with the beer. And now, you're messing with me and millions of other beer drinkers. Like I said, it's personal.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
And we take a question now from CNNPolitics.com. You can see it up on the screen here. Since birth control is the latest hot topic, which candidate believes in birth control, and if not, why? As you can see, it's a very popular question.
It's
you
a
have.
Very popular question in the audience, as we can see.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. You knew it was a conservative crowd when they started groaning over actually doing something intelligent like protecting yourself from having children. I know, we're pro-children. We love the children. Except after they're born. Then we want to take away their school lunch. Then we want to say that their parents don't love them if they can't afford to. It's just mind-blowing. Mind-blowing. Interesting. Blowing. That's probably not the right way to go on that. Interesting story I got from Canada. I would argue Canada is probably a lot more progressive than we are here in the U.S., even though they've got their conservative element. The country's leader is technically a conservative. I would argue probably not as crazy as the conservatives that we have, but still technically considered, I guess, a conservative, where they actually regulate stuff in Canada. And the Canadian Broadcasting Regulator, and you can't make this up. I mean, it's amazing stuff. The guy who oversees the Canadian broadcasting, unlike our FCC, who can't seem to do anything to regulate our airwaves in a non-corporate, non-consolidation fashion. The Canadian Broadcasting Regulator claims that they want to see more locally made porn. Got to have more locally made porn on Canadian television, according to the Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunications Commissioner. They said three Toronto-based adult channels have failed to provide the minimum of 35% Canadian content. Now, first, I think I have a problem with this. Don't we have a free trade agreement with the good folks of Canada? So shouldn't we be able to export our porn to Canada? I'm being... I didn't know they had a 35% rule. In fact, I didn't even know they regulated. Anyway, the rules require a portion of the programming to at least be partly written, produced, and presented by people of Canada. Now, is it possible that people in Canada don't like to be filmed while doing their thing? I don't know. Or maybe they're just not paying enough. I don't know. But there's going to be a hearing scheduled. It will be April 4th. And they're going to decide whether the broadcast license of a number of these companies will be renewed. Now, I wonder if they will have crazy conservatives out there screaming, oh, shut it down, shut it down, shut it down, shut it down. It's bad, it's bad, it's horrible. We'd rather see them killing each other. Give them guns. Isn't that what it is? Quick break, right back, stick around.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a settlement with New York's Attorney General, owners of Lage Car Washes in New York City will pay $3.9 million for unpaid wages and underreporting of employees on state unemployment and workers' compensation forms. The Retail Worker Union, RWDSU, and Community Allies are waging an anti-wage theft campaign that highlighted these abuses. The car wash chains will pay $2.2 million to 1,000 workers for nearly 6 years of unpaid wages owed them. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says that when workers like these stand up for their rights, they need to know that state and city leaders will stand behind them.
Unions exist to encourage economic growth and try to spread some of that prosperity to the workers who are out there producing the productivity that drives the economic engine. No one ever has the argument in the right-wing media sphere about the interests of the actual workers themselves. If you are part of a union, you're going to have higher wages than national average wage. Generally, being part of a union is a good thing if you're a worker.
Media Matters economic researcher Craig Harrington. Corporate and conservative media myths about unions create an incessant drumbeat of misinformation and lies about the labor movement that often lead to anti-union policies. Media Matters wants to set the record straight on some of those myths. Harrington says among the myths are that unions caused the auto industry's problems in Detroit, that unions reduce competitiveness, and that good union wages and benefits are driving auto and other companies to send jobs to other countries.
There's a claim that the United Auto Workers Union and union in general were behind the collapse of the Detroit auto industry, which is blatantly false, but it's something that was an important talking point in right-wing media circles, particularly as the UAW ramped up its attempts to push for a unionization vote in Tennessee. Detroit was caused by decades of mismanagement, the forces of globalization, and general economic decline around the country in the early 2000s, and it really hit Detroit and hit Michigan hard.
Media Matters says the facts are that unions deliver positive benefits for the broader economy, they're vital to reduce inequality, and they increase productivity. New Hampshire's Republican-controlled state Senate has voted to accept federal money to expand Medicaid coverage. About 50,000 people in New Hampshire would benefit from the health protection program passed by an 18-5 margin in New Hampshire's Senate. Democrats control the state House, and the governor supports the bill. A New England College poll shows 66% of New Hampshire residents support the legislation. Tea Party Republicans, though, were and are against it. But the Republican-controlled Senate vote was consistent with widespread majority support from New Hampshire hospitals, doctors, nurses, working families, and business owners for taking that federal money to expand Medicaid.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org. The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therichsmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therichsmithshow.com. So the big conservative action committee get together, the circus. The circus was in Washington today, and one of the notable people missing You know, you had the Donald Trumps, you had the Paul Ryans, you had Rand Paul, Chris Christie, you had all the regular clowns and characters. No Scott Walker. And why no Scott Walker? I was really looking forward to seeing some of his shtick on stage. Any idea or reason why not? Maybe it's a gubernatorial year, election year. Don't want to look too crazy to the folks there in Wisconsin. Pretty much the same reason that our governor probably wasn't there. Anyway, here to talk to us about what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So, you know, no Scott Walker today at the circus.
You know, that's so disappointing because it's kind of like who can top whom in quote of the year or quote of the CPAC, and he would do so well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what gets me about this is, you know, never anything positive comes out of it. It's all been about, and from what I've been seeing, and maybe I'm wrong, but all I've been seeing is pointing at Obama, you know, how he stinks, and how if we would just drill more, Putin wouldn't have gone into Ukraine, and if someone had a little brown bag, they would care more. Just a lot of just insanity.
And that story, of course, has been completely debunked by the Washington Post fact-checkers, the brown bag story. First of all, the person who originally told that story in testimony, the story was incorrect, and then Ryan's version of it was incorrect, so the story's like wrong for wrong, doubly wrong.
But it makes such a nice story. You know, what a facts beat that? Who cares about the facts? It really fits the narrative. It fits the that pull yourself up. I don't need any help from you. It fits all of those frames so nicely.
Well, then who cares?
Exactly. I mean, it's like most of the anecdotal stories that they tell, even though this one wasn't supposed to be anecdotal, this one was actually supposed to have happened, right?
It was supposed to have happened, but it didn't.
Kind of like the welfare queen and the who's driving around in the Cadillac, you know, eating steak and drinking Dom Perignon with the family farmer who lost his farm because of the estate tax. You mean those kind of real folks?
Those kinds of stories. Yes, they didn't happen. No.
And good. I'm glad somebody finally paid attention to it, because normally that stuff just rolls right off, and it makes for such a nice story, and oh, people then start to repeat it ad nauseum, like it was actual fact.
The Washington Post did an in-depth check. They went and spoke to the woman who gave the testimony before Congress, and she said, no, it happened like this, and in fact, this was wrong, and that was wrong, and they checked this, and they checked that, it was great. It was, well, I don't know when he spoke. He must have spoken the day before yesterday. He spoke yesterday. I read the piece. I read the fact check, and it was extremely, they gave him four Pinocchios.
As they should. But, you know, that's what investigative reporting, and that's what actually a functional media should be doing, shouldn't it?
Yes. And why do we sound so surprised?
I got to be honest. I was shocked when I read it. I'm going, somebody bothered to look into anything, these people? Really? Someone looked into it? Well, good on them, and it's about time. Maybe we'll see more of it on all sides of the political spectrum.
Don't get too excited.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was excited yesterday. I saw, you know, Big Eddie had another big awakening, another big epiphany. Ed Schultz, who was in favor of the Keystone XL pipeline just a couple of weeks ago. A lot of headlines, a lot of news, a lot of backslapping. Hooray for him. And then grand epiphany, now something to do with water and needing to drink it, and he's changed his mind.
Ed Schultz changed his mind?
Yeah, I mean, you know, changed his mind.
I didn't know that.
Sure, he changed his mind from being a conservative to being a liberal, and now he's changed his mind from being a pro driller on the Keystone XL pipeline coming through to changing his mind about some big aquifer where we have water, because, you know, we have to drink water and need water to put on the crops in Nebraska so the farmers can have food and we can eat. You know, just kind of that whole hippie liberal environmentalist angle that, you know, he seemed to have poo-pooed away just a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, that.
Well, he said go and join Academy Award-winning actor Jared. I always want to pronounce it. Is it Leto? Jared Leto?
Yeah, sounds close.
Anyway, the really good-looking guy from Dallas Buyers Club. and 13 other activists, the grandson of Robert F. Kennedy, Augusta guitarist Adam Gardner, anyway, any number of people, they're all calling on Secretary of State John Kerry to reject the Keystone XL pipeline. They spoke with top State Department officials yesterday. They sent a letter to Kerry. They dug deep into his past. In 1971, when you were roughly our age, that must have hurt, you asked, how can you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake? We stand at such a point today with respect to an even greater challenge, an even bigger mistake, the imminent threat of catastrophic climate disruption. We dare to believe that it's not just an accident of history, but this recommendation falls to you.
Wow.
Yeah, and over 1 million comments are being sent to State Department today, urging Kerry to say no to the pipeline. And about at least 500,000 comments are being sent to State urging the President to approve the pipeline. Maybe a million are going to State approve the pipeline. So you've got a million one way and a million the other way, all having to get in under a probably 5 p.m., I imagine it will be, deadline today, which is the end of the comment period, after which agencies, and I think there are 8 federal agencies, can you imagine, they have 60 days to discuss whether the $5.4 billion pipeline is in the national interest, and not all the agencies are going to agree on this.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, but I just don't see how it is in the national interest. Just from my, no, look, I'm in favor of building stuff, I'm in favor of being energy independent. I just don't see how this, helps us, building a pipeline right down the middle of the country so we can take Canadian oil and just put it right out the port there in Texas. And they say we'll be able to refine it in Texas. I'm going, well, you know, we're not doing a whole lot of refining here in the U.S. We're shipping that somewhere else to be refined as well, so we're not even getting that those jobs.
Well, and this is one of the things that, that the State Department has said. There's a very interesting poll in today's Washington Post talking about how public support is for the pipeline, and it's quite high for the pipeline, with people believing it is going to create quite a lot of jobs. I don't have the numbers in front of me at this second, but believing it's going to create quite a lot of jobs. But the numbers of jobs that people believe it's going to create, which is one of the reasons why they support the pipeline, isn't even supported by the State Department's own environmental review, which supports the pipeline, which comes in at a much lower number of jobs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, here in Pennsylvania, our governor's running around saying he's the more jobs governor. He claims that the drilling in the Marcellus Shale fields, that's created 220,000 jobs. But when you actually look at the jobs that he's claiming were part of this, they have nothing to do with what's going on in the areas that are being drilled. You know, they're taking sewer jobs in Philadelphia. There's no gas near Philadelphia. And claiming those were created because of the drilling that's going on. And a whole bunch of, you know, long-haul truck driving somehow is tied to the drilling. So I guess you could throw a whole bunch of stuff in there and say, oh, this is all part of it. And it's not.
Well, they do. I have seen, it depends how you calculate it. You could say that 200 jobs are created, or you could say 1,000 jobs are created if you want to say that, well, people have to go to the dentist, people have to go, these guys have to get their hair cut, and so, you know, you add barbers, you add dentists, and then suddenly those jobs are created too.
So then let me get this straight then, because, you know, then, I could be, if it's all just about the jobs, then I could be for the Keystone Pipeline then. Because when it leaks, and Big Eddie said it's going to leak, because he said all pipelines leak. When he had the epiphany and he had this awakening, it's going to leak, and we know this. It's going to get into the water. It's going to taint the water. People are probably going to drink it, and like the Freedom Water in West Virginia, then they'll vomit uncontrollably. They'll have to go to the doctor. That'll create doctor jobs and nursing jobs. And, of course, buckets, you're going to need buckets to collect the said uncontrollable vomits. This could be a win-win for jobs then.
Yes, it's a good thing.
Unless you're the one uncontrollably vomiting.
Don't you love the word bucket?
I do love the word bucket. I just worry that it could be misconstrued by the FCC and I could be off the air.
It's true.
which is why I don't use it very often. Ah, bucket.
I understand.
There you go.
I understand. And you said it and I didn't.
There we go. But job numbers out. Good, bad,
yes.
175,000? Is that a good number?
It's considered good, and I'll tell you why. And the New York Times says that the numbers were considered good and that they eased fears that the economy was entering a winter wobble. And so we didn't enter a winter wobble, and I'll tell you why. Because people actually did have jobs created. We're not quite sure why, and it seems to be because the economy is recovering. And what's interesting is that the 71 economists polled by Thomson Reuters estimated 150,000 odd jobs. We got 175. The weather was appalling during February. During the week that this survey was done, it's done during a particular week, there was a terrible storm on the East Coast, an even worse storm in the Southeast, during which masses of businesses closed completely. And so this is one of the reasons they thought this is going to be really bad. Despite that, there were 175,000 jobs created, indicating that, hey, if there had been decent weather, these numbers could have really been quite good.
Okay. Or you could have been snow shoveling jobs. You do
they
need to take out.
Could have been snow shoveling jobs. Yes, but what's interesting is when you look at the jobs that were created, the jobs actually were white-collar jobs.
Wow.
Not so many blue-collar jobs, partly probably because people were not hiring in construction in February.
That and no new manufacturing jobs really either, I think. 2013 was one of the worst of the worst years for manufacturing jobs. And in fact, you know, what gets me is the manufacturing we are bringing back. We're mechanizing and we're funding the mechanization, and we're not actually hiring people. So but we're bringing manufacturing back, Victoria, or so I'm told. But that's a good thing. It's a good thing. A job. So unemployment went down then, right?
Unemployment went up, but there's by ticked up 0.1%. But they think that that is because people went back into the labor force and started looking.
Yeah, a little more optimistic, a little more hopeful. Good. So good. We're going into the spring, some optimism.
Hopey changey.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to. We'll see what happens. What's going on in the Ukraine right now? Still some tension. Still, I know the CPAC people pointing the finger at Obama, saying, you know, he wears mommy pants, and of course. Putin, he wrestles bears and drills.
Yeah, well, it's entirely President Obama's fault because, you know, Benghazi. You know.
Exactly. And the IRS, of course. Let's not forget that.
And the IRS and Obamacare.
Exactly.
I came up with that one myself. Nobody else has said that yet.
I have.
But I'm starting that one now.
I've said all of those. It's all of that stuff.
Yeah.
It's all of
all
that
of
stuff.
That. All of that stuff.
You know, it's the fact that, you know, he woke up. Everything's his fault.
Yes.
And, you know, some of the experts that I've talked to have said, look, you know, it doesn't matter who was sitting in the White House. If this happened, Putin was going to make the move. It just is what it is. We don't have a force there. And it'll be interesting to see how this vote goes, because I understand that the folks there in Crimea are going to have a vote on whether they're going to head the Russian way, right?
Right. On March the 16th, which is a little more than a week away, and you've got a 58-59% Russian, Russian-ish population in Crimea. They are going to support it. And the way, apparently, this ballot is written from people who have seen either drafts or the ballot itself is either, do you want to be part of the Russian Federation or do you want to be part of Ukraine? There isn't a third option, which is, do you want to be an independent Crimea, which might have been an interesting option? That's not on the ballot. And the ballot is written first in Russian, hint, hint, and second in Ukrainian.
Well, I would assume the third option, or the second option, would have been, do you want to be part of the Russian Federation, or do you want to die?
Well, there is, but that's written in invisible ink.
Is that what that is? Right across the top in blood, then, right?
Yes, well, basically.
It will be interesting
not,
to see where
not,
that takes
not everybody wants to join. I mean, you've got a sizable Ukrainian minority, and you've got the Tatars who do not want to join the Russian Federation. And they are not going to have a choice in the matter, and this is going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, some of the people that I've talked to and some of the experts that I've said, you know, I've talked to have said, look, you know, yeah, the folks have a Russian-type culture and they want to maintain that. But none of them seem overly committed to the idea that the folks in that area want to be part of Russia again. They kind of, from the way it's been explained to me, they're quite happy, you know, the way they are.
Yeah, quite a lot of people are happy the way they are. But this is going to happen. Crimea, it looks like, is going to be annexed. I mean, this is just going to happen despite the West jumping up and down saying you can't do this in the 21st century. Apparently you can.
Well, you can. I mean, the fact that John Kerry even said that just mocks of hypocrisy. Are you kidding me? Didn't we just do something kind of like that not too long ago?
Who did we do that to?
Iraq. Didn't we just go into Iraq to meet our own ends for our own pretext? I seem to remember aluminum tubes, and I seem to remember cake.
Well, we did that, but we didn't take them over and annex them for our own purposes.
Well, because nobody would let us. We wanted the oil. At least that's my view on it, personally. Since we're in Russia, what's going on with Edward Snowden?
Edward Snowden, two things are going on with Edward Snowden. One is that he's given a testimony to the European Parliament released this morning, in which he said that he reported policy or legal issues related to spying programs to more than 10 officials before he leaked his documents, and that his warnings fell on deaf ears. He said as a contractor he had no legal avenue to pursue further whistleblowing. Then he was asked specifically if he felt like he'd exhausted all other avenues before deciding to leak. He said, yes, I'd reported these clearly problematic programs to more than 10 distinct officials, none of whom took any action to address them. As an employee of a private company rather than a direct employee of the U.S. government, I was not protected by U.S. whistleblower laws, and I would not have been protected from retaliation and legal sanction for revealing classified information about law-breaking in accordance with the recommended process. Now, this is the first time we've heard that he spoke to more than 10 officials, and that's something that the NSA has been denying by saying that he hasn't spoken to all these people. Now, whether he did or whether these people are keeping quiet, he says the responses fell into two camps. The first were well-meaning but hushed warnings not to rock the boat for fear of retaliation that fell former NSA whistleblowings like Weaver, Binney, and Drake, and they were all people who were subject to intense scrutiny and the threat of criminal prosecution. And the other responses were suggestions that he let the issue be someone else's problem.
That sounds about right. I can see that.
Yeah.
My problem is, though, you said he spoke to 10 people. I can't imagine that it would have gotten. I'm not saying he didn't, because I personally think the guy should be. We should have parades for him because of all the stuff that we now know. But 10 people, you go after the first two or three, don't they just turn and look at he's trouble, get rid of him, and then you end up getting him fired.
Well, you would think so, except it makes me wonder because he's working for Booz Allen at this time. You know, I know somebody who works for Booz Allen. And I get the impression that maybe it's possible. Is it possible that the climate is such that people didn't tell other people that he had spoken to them, that they were nervous?
Yeah, could be. No, last night we talked with Peter Van Buren. He was a State Department guy for almost a quarter of a century. And got himself into one of these situations where, you know, he was trying to bring some things to light, and boy, they went after him, and he was talking about this all the whistleblower stuff, and it's amazing how layers of secrecy upon layers of secrecy. I'm not thrilled with it. I guess that's the bottom line on there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway,
I'm with you.
Lastly and finally. The IRS, the little IRS hearing the other day with ISA playing the bully. What's going on here?
Well, Daryl ISA is going to plow ahead. Forward. The IRS has agreed to hand over emails and other documents from Lois Lerner, who, of course, is a core player in the agency targeting controversy. But they're not handing over these emails and docs to Daryl Issa's committee, the House Oversight Committee. They're handing them over to the House Ways and Means Committee, which is Dave Camp's committee. But Ways and Means and Oversight are sharing information. So you would think that Oversight, that the Daryl Issa's committee, would then plow forward with these documents. But instead, it sounds like what he's going to do is move forward with holding Lois Lerner in contempt of Congress rather than plowing through all the documents and moving forward with that evidence, which there is going to be evidence in there of something,
right,
whatever it is, whether it's for or against her. So by moving forward with contempt of Congress, he's pretty much guaranteed to have another showdown with Elijah Cummings.
Well, I mean, that's all this is really about. And I truly believe this is just about getting him on the evening news and getting his mug plastered everywhere. And his and it's about him, because I don't see that there's any here, any there. This is purely political. This has nothing to do with making the IRS run any better or any of that stuff. It's purely his wanting to try and find a scandal, manufacture something, and then just more bad IRS, bad.
He does seem to have a proclivity for getting headlines.
Yeah.
Yeah. That way.
Tell him there's a Chevy down on the corner. The keys are in the ignition. There you go. Sad stuff. Victoria, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you so much.
All righty. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Hear this from the Rick Smith Show.
For and by we, the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Making the blue blood see red.
The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome to the new dark ages. Yeah, I hope you're living right. These are the new dark ages. And the world might end tonight.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I got to tell you, the only thing I want you to take away from tonight, Paul Ryan's an a-hole. That's the only thing I can come up with. That's the line. That's...